Good afternoon, members. Here we are in our part one of education policy meeting today. Our first order of business will be to approve the minutes from our last meeting, which was Tuesday, March 12th. And Representative Berg, have you had a moment to review the minutes, and would you motion for the approval?
Yes, Madam Chair. I was just looking them over, and I move the approval of the minutes.
Thank you. Any discussion on the minutes from March 12th? All right, hearing none, all in favor of approving the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. The minutes are approved. Thank you. Well, we have a number of bills that we'll be hearing today and discussing. There's the bills that we heard the testimony from yesterday and that we're going to continue the discussion of. But I think we'll start with the new bills right now, and then at the end of this session, return to the bills from yesterday for discussion. And we have first up, House File 3682, Representative Katiza Watun as our chief author of this bill. You're not currently a member of this committee, though you have been in the past, Representative Katun, so Katiza Watun. So I think I will have, if Representative Berg, if you would move also House File 3682 to be before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House File 3682 to be before the committee.
Thank you, Representative Berg. And I believe there's also an author's amendment for
correct,
this.
Madam Chair.
Right, so it's the A4 amendment. Just briefly, would you describe how this A4 amendment changes the bill?
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair. So the A4 amendment gets the bill into the shape I would like after some additional feedback from the Department of Education and the Minnesota Youth Council.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Berg, would you also motion the A4 amendment before us for approval?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I move the A4 for approval.
Thank you. All right, any discussion to the A4 amendment before we discuss the bill? All right, all in favor of the A4 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you, members. All right, the 3682 as amended with the A4. So Representative Katiza Watun, please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm proud to be carrying House File 3682, a bill that would standardize health education across our state. I would like to give just a brief introduction of the bill, and then I will ask House Counsel to walk through the specifics of the language. But members, as we know, in today's changing world, our children have more exposure to technology and all the things that come with it than ever before. So this access and exposure can create a variety of challenges for them as they grow and learn. House File 3682 will standardize health education across the state, which is a crucial step in ensuring that all students, regardless of their location, receive a consistent education related not only to their own health, but also the well-being of their family, friends, and their community. This bill utilizes the rulemaking process, allowing for any and all interested parties to engage the Department of Education in this process. Currently, health education is the only required subject matter in Minnesota that is not standardized. Rulemaking allows for a transparent process that will require the input and buy-in of a variety of stakeholders. These stakeholders are then compiled into a standards committee, which participates in this process. This includes parents of school-age children, teachers, and faculty throughout the state, school board members, members of our tribal nations, and now students with input from the Minnesota Youth Council. After this standards committee completes their recommendations, there is ample opportunity for public comment and consideration. Minnesota statute related to this matter specifically stipulates that the standards created are clear and objective and do not require a certain teaching methodology. Simply put, the process of rulemaking and crafting this bill and carrying it toward eventual implementation is a process that's objective and relies on important checks and balances while being open to the public at key junctures. So, Madam Chair, if Ms. Parra would walk through the specifics of the bill, and then we can move to testimony.
Thank you, Representative Katiza-Watun. Ms. Parra.
Madam Chair and members, Christina Parra from House Research. The bill, the first several sections of the bill modify the language related to standards generally, adding health to the list of state standards and removing it from, well, it's currently the only local standard. So, for example, in Section 1, number 2 of the list is struck there and health is added to the state standards. In Section 2, line 2.4, it's also striking the locally developed requirement for health standards. But there's a paragraph there at the end of the section adding that the locally developed standards would continue to apply until either at the end of the 25-26 school year or until the commissioner adopts the statewide rules implementing the state health standards, whichever occurs later. Section 3, again, adding health to the list of the state standards. That's the section that talks about the groups that the commissioner considers advice from. And in the amendment that you have before you, there is an added line, a new number 7 at the end of that list, that would require the commissioner to seek input from current students and the Minnesota Youth Council. Section 4 is the rulemaking statute, the rulemaking provision, and this would require the commissioner to adopt statewide rules for the state, for the health standards. Section 5, this is the provision that says that the standards are all reviewed on a 10-year cycle, so it's adding the health standards to that 10-year cycle in the new paragraph H on line 512. Section 6, this section of statute lists the credits that students need to complete to graduate from high school. And so you'll see there, for example, they need 3 credits of math, et cetera. This adds credits sufficient to satisfy the health standards. So it doesn't enumerate how many credits would be necessary. It says sufficient to satisfy the standards, which is similar to what is in the requirements for physical education in number 6. Section 7, so this in the amendment that's before you, this section is deleted and is instead, replaced by a codified section. So that's what's in the amendment before you, starting on line 1.7, the health education standards. And subdivision 1 requires the commissioner to begin the rulemaking process to adopt the standards. And then requires the rules to include at least the expectations for student learning that are in subdivision 2, and then may include the expectations in subdivision 3. So to go through those in subdivision 2, these are requirements that are currently in statute. For example, CPR and automatic external defibrillator education, that's currently in 120B236. So that's instruction that districts are currently required to provide. So number 1 through 5, those are all currently in statute. Number 5 is mental health education. That's currently in encouragement in statute. But in this bill, it is in the required subject areas. And then subdivision 3 are subject areas that the commissioner may include in the standards. And these are all the current statutes encourage districts to provide that instruction. For example, character development education or child sexual abuse prevention education. Then section 8 of the bill is a blank appropriation to the department to complete the rulemaking. And Madam Chair members, that's the bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Kerr, for walking us through that. We appreciate that. It's complicated. It is. Thank you. And I believe now we have testifiers that they're all in person. And I have first up Jeanette Jimenez, an intern with the Women's Foundation of Minnesota. And then also after that, it will be Koji Del Rosario from Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. So if you can be ready. You can introduce yourself and begin with your testimony.
Honorable members of the committee, for the record, my name is Janet Jimenez, and I am a fellow and program manager at the Women's Foundation of Minnesota. Thank you for the chance to testify today in support for House File 3682, which will represent a pivotal step forward towards ensuring students across the state of Minnesota to get an opportunity to learn what they need to grow up safe, healthy, and confident. As mentioned, the current health education standards are not set across the state level, which means that depending on where you live in Minnesota, this will determine what students learn about essential topics such as violence prevention, substance abuse, mental health, and reproductive health. The essence of House File 3682 lies in the commitments of the well-being of young people and providing them with the necessary tools to make informed decisions with positive impacts in their lives and the lives of their peers. The knowledge shared in classrooms has value for their lives long after school is over. By passing this bill, we will not only safeguard the well-being of young people, but also foster a society that values all people. It is imperative to recognize that young people are at risk of continued health hazards such as disease, psychological stressors, substance misuse, violence, and more without these standards. A holistic health education approach is essential to preventing harm and catering safer, more equitable, and thriving communities across the state. The repercussions of inaction are far-reaching and can perpetuate cycles of poor diet habits within students, lack of exercise awareness, unawareness of common mental health conditions such as anxiety, depression, and stress, and coping mechanisms to combat these things. Health disparities also are a big impact within the approach of the health standards because not everyone has access to a health education within their homes, and it would be easier if they can get access to this in schools. As a part of my role at the foundation, I work with a youth group and focus on policies that relate to their everyday lives. And from these youth, I have also learned that there is a need for a statewide health nurse and support for their ability to grow and learn with healthy lives. As a representative of the people, you have the moral obligation to ensure that every individual in the state of Minnesota has access to proper health and helps them, which will help them live a healthy life, a more safe life, and a confident life. We urge you to pass this proposal to ensure students in Minnesota to have access to education on health subjects, and will allow them to live a fully and healthy lives. Thank you for your time and your consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have from the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, Poji Del Rosario. If you can introduce yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Pryor and members of the committee. My name is Poji Del Rosario, and I'm one of the prevention program coordinators at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, or MNCASA. MNCASA's vision is that of a world free of sexual violence, in which all human beings are treated with dignity and respect, and communities are transformed through safety, healing, and partnerships. Our vision is directly in line with the contents of this bill, and today we are demonstrating support for House File 3682. We want youth across the state of Minnesota to have access to education that provides the knowledge and skills to make informed decisions that will positively impact them throughout their lifespan. MNCASA has convened over 100 Minnesotans committed to this cause. The Health and Well-being Education Standards Work Group is comprised of advocates, health educators, students, parents, and community members. This coalition of Minnesotans seeks to take actionable steps toward ensuring that all young people are equipped with the means to attain their highest levels of health. This work group includes both health experts and those who would be most impacted by those standards, students. It is imperative to listen to and uplift these voices and their experiences. MNCASA is dedicated to the primary prevention of violence. Primary prevention is taking steps to stop violence before it can occur. The implementation of such health standards would build foundational skills in effective communication, character development, and teachings of consent. These core strategies of primary prevention aim to eliminate risk factors and promote protective factors for Minnesotans. This bill would facilitate collective community efforts to prevent harm and center positive health outcomes. To fulfill a vision of a world free from sexual violence, transformative change is necessary. House File 3682 provides the opportunity to make crucial health improvements for all Minnesotans. A holistic approach to health education is essential for preventing harm and creating safer and thriving communities across the state.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I have Dr. Sheldon Berkowitz from Children's Minnesota, and after that I have from Minnesota Youth Council, Ayla, who will be on deck. Please proceed, Dr. Berkowitz.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for allowing me to speak today. My name is Dr. Sheldon Berkowitz. I'm a retired pediatrician and am the immediate past president of the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Our chapter represents over 1,000 pediatricians in the state, many of whom are in the chamber today for Pediatricians Day at the Capitol. We advocate for the health, safety, and well-being of our patients, Minnesota's children. I'm here to testify in favor of House File 3682. This bill aims to improve the academic standards for Minnesota students to include elements necessary for a well-rounded health education. We are not doing a good job at preparing our children to live healthy, thriving lives. Kids today are facing multiple challenges to their mental and physical health, and the earlier we can teach them about how to take care of their own health, the better. In my over 35 years working as a pediatrician, with the last 20 at Children's Minnesota, I've seen increased rates of mental health concerns such as depression and anxiety among adolescents, higher rates of eating disorders, childhood obesity, and diseases such as type 2 diabetes among school-aged children, and increased rates of emotional and sexual abuse among youth of all ages. Additionally, Minnesota's kids need to be educated about how to live a healthy life in the year 2024 and beyond. In a world filled with access to vaping and cannabis products marketed towards children, where every kid has multiple social media accounts, and where any child who is old enough to type can expose themselves to all the information and open communication of the internet, we need to conscientiously do better by our kids. This bill would help ensure children and families from every corner of the state will receive consistent education related to their own health and that of their family and communities. On behalf of the state's pediatricians, I am grateful to Representative Cotiza Witoon for bringing this bill forward, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. We have our testifier from the Minnesota Youth Council. If you can step forward. Actually, I think we have two testifiers, if the second can be on deck. You can introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ayla Mackey-Brud, and I am a representative on the Minnesota Youth Council, as well as an 11th grader at Twin Cities Academy High School. I'm here to speak on behalf of myself and all young people across Minnesota who are relying on our school system to educate us and prepare us for our futures. The purpose of quality education is to prepare young people for becoming active and successful members of society, as well as teaching skills for everyday life and wellness. School prepares us by teaching college preparatory skills and career skills, and by teaching us mathematics and reading and the sciences, and yet many young people have no idea how to take care of their own minds and bodies because curriculums lack fundamental health education. Currently, our schools are not meeting their purpose of supporting students in this way. Educating students about mental health gives them the power to identify when they need help and gives them the knowledge and resources to know how to address it and where to go. Many young people, including some teenagers that I am close with, have already had to talk several of their peers out of committing suicide. These situations demonstrate a significant problem in our system of education. Children should not be responsible for saving lives. Schools have an obligation to teach us what to do in a crisis, and more importantly, how to prevent the crisis from ever happening. Many young people do not have an understanding of how to get help if they are struggling with their mental health. Most of my peers have never known how to access therapy or counseling, and many of them don't know about the suicide hotline or how to use it. Sex education is not a mandatory class in many schools, and drug education is mandatory in even fewer. Without statewide education standards, not all of Minnesota students have access to equal support in these areas. Statewide health standards allow all students across the state to have equal access to curriculums and prevent any disparities. Making mental health a part of school curriculums forces people to talk about it and destigmatizes honest conversations surrounding mental illness, suicide, and self-harm. Required health curriculums will provide students with the knowledge and skills they need to have happier and healthier futures. And so I urge you all to please vote in support of House File 3682.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. And also from the Minnesota Youth Council, Adona Knight? Maybe not. I appreciate that. Usually you don't see this many pediatricians in one room. Thank you for being with us today. I think we'll have to recognize you there. I did not have an appointment today. I really feel like I missed out. So you don't live in Minnetonka or Eden Prairie, okay? That's all right. Thank you. Thank you for being here and for witnessing. All right. We have no more testifiers on our list. And we'll turn to member discussion. Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. I just can't help myself sometimes to ask some questions. I love this bill. Two questions I have. We're starting on line 712. We talk about mental health, and I agree we absolutely need to talk about it. Can you just walk me through if that would include talking about the 988 access? I know that we put that on all of our student IDs. One of the things that I've learned as I've been in high schools is we're not actually talking about that resource very well in schools. Can you tell us if the mental health concept of this would include access to 988 and how to utilize that?
Representative Petit, would you?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Keeler, for bringing that up. I did make a note of that when our student testifier shared her concerns specifically about suicide. In the amendment, I just want to point out that we did shift, as Ms. Pera had mentioned earlier, shift mental health from the encourage section of the standards that are currently in statute into the required for discussion. So we were saying mental health must be included in whatever is put forth throughout the rulemaking process. We don't have the 988 number specifically included in that at this point in time, but I'm open to adding that potentially in a parenthesis or something, but I know that as throughout the rulemaking process that we're including that on student IDs and just making sure awareness is growing across the state. I'm sure that would be something that the experts would probably want to be included.
Mm-hmm. And as we heard the description of as you described the rulemaking process, there is, the stakeholders coming and being brought intentionally forward to do a draft and then the public comment. And so we know that it's all up to all of us to watch the standards as they unfold and make sure that, that crucial piece of information would be added to it, even if it's not, listed specifically as part of the statute that introduces the rulemaking for health standards. It doesn't mean that somehow we're going to leave. I mean, I don't think that's possible to leave it out, but that would be my opinion, and I'm not an expert. Representative Keeler.
Thanks. Continue to plug that we have 988, I guess, is where it's at, on record, legislative intent, to make sure that we continue to talk about that with our kids. My next question, I'm not really sure where it lands with the amendment, but is around the sexual abuse and violence prevention. I just want to add that as we do the student breakdowns, one of the elements that I would hope that we would continue to talk about is sex and human trafficking. Signs of this, we're seeing that the student report is increasing in yes responses to have they engaged or interacted in this in their communities, and actually the highest percent of yes is Northwest Minnesota. So just another legislative intent as we move forward in this conversation. I think talking about violence and sexual assault is really important, but adding the human trafficking piece on top of that. So for whatever that's worth, I really like the bill. Good work. I just would like those two things noted in the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. Representative Bakeberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Tiza Watun. It's a mouthful.
You got it right.
I have a little different perspective on this bill. I think as we sit and we listen to discussion testimony. If I wasn't in a school, you know, often I would think, well, there's nothing being done in our schools around these different topics, and nothing could be further from the truth. There is a ton of work around all of the topics outlined in the bill that school districts are working really hard on, and I think the disconnect for me in this bill really centers around local control, because the process of identifying how to address the different topics, it has really been worked on hard at the individual district level with student input from that school district, parent input from that school district. And as I go through the bill, I just have concerns about removing that local authority and that local autonomy. So line 1.11, you know, we strike the provision for locally adopted expectations for learning health. Moving through 2.6, same thing. You know, and then going into the standards and effective dates, like if we didn't learn anything in last session, we should learn that we have to be very cautious of our effective dates and the implementation of things, because that ties the hands of our districts. I would agree with Rep. Keeler about trafficking and human trafficking, about having conversations and warning signs. We need to have those conversations with our kids. 988 in my building, it's on the back of every kid's ID. It's in their student planner. We ordered fancy little stickers to do that. So districts are figuring this stuff out based off of the legislation that we passed that best fit their local communities. And I think as I went through, and it might be my numbers might be off with the DE, but I counted 7 times that it says must in this bill. And I've said it before, I'm going to continue to say it. When we say must, what school districts hear is this is a mandate. And we at this table are telling our local school districts how to do this topic. And it's touchy. If you would like to come and spend a day with a principal or be involved in a conversation with a teacher who, you know, maybe didn't communicate the way that they should have, or a principal didn't communicate, it's not fun. And what we are doing right now is saying, local school board, you have no say in this. We're going to develop this at the state level, and we're going to get input, but the locally elected officials don't have a say. And I think the letter from the school board, from MSBA and the different groups, they really outline it well about what happens at the local level. Community engagement, number one, that fosters trust in the local community. The people that are elected to our local school boards, they're local community members. Diverse local needs. There are different needs, and through the process, those needs are heard, those needs are valued, and when you hear that, it builds trust. And then it's accountability and responsibility. If the local district gets something wrong, they are locally accountable. If someone from, you know, Duluth, Minnesota, I don't think anyone's from Duluth here, has an issue, you know, the constituents of Duluth don't have a voice over this bill at this committee table. Obviously, through the process they do, but not at this committee table. And so for that reason, we need to continue to support our local districts, local autonomy, to be able to meet the needs. So thank you, and I just respectfully can't support this.
Chair Youakim.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Breyer, and thank you, Representative Khadiza-Watoon, for bringing this bill forward. Sometimes I know exactly what we're doing, and sometimes I get confused when other people talk, so I just want to clear things up. Is there anything in this bill that prohibits a local school board to add on to something on top of the standards? I know the standards process is a lengthy one. It can take up to 2 years. we actually, part of the standards is having teachers and local electeds at the table, or representatives from those groups, and the business community. It looks like in our underlying standards development process, it's parents of school age. I'm looking at subdivision 2 on lines 3.11. Parents of school age children must be part of the standards development. Teachers, administrators, members of local school boards and charter school boards throughout the state, faculty teaching corps, TNEC, which is important, business community, because, you know, we educate the future workforce, totally get that. I'm glad that you're adding the Minnesota Youth Council, because I think that's what's been missing in some of the standards process until the last few years. So those folks are at the table with our experts, because as elected officials, I'd be worried about me telling people what they should learn in health. And they're going to develop that base standard for the graduation requirement we already have in place. Is there anything in here that says the school district can't add on top of that requirement?
Representative Katisa-Witun.
Madam Chair and Chair Joachim, no, districts certainly could go above and beyond what would be included at the end of the rulemaking process. And the standardizing a specific subject matter doesn't require certain teaching methodologies or styles. Local units would still be responsible for determining how their students do reach, like, the destination of learning about mental health. And I think that, you know, as we continue moving forward, and the insight that we've heard from pediatricians and the students who came to the table, one of the great things I think about including the Minnesota Youth Council in this process is that the Minnesota Youth Council you know, contains students from each congressional district, across the state. And so the variety of insights that we're going to get from greater Minnesota and the suburbs and the metro area, but then, of course, local districts would still be able to go beyond what is established.
Just one quick follow-up, Chair Pryor, is that okay? And it's more of a comment or a question. Do you want comments later or just now?
I think we'll discussion.
Okay. Got it. So I just want to say, so folks know this, it's been a long day already, tonight's going to be rough, that we already require a half a credit to graduate in health. We have many other graduation requirements. Every single one of the other graduation requirements have standards set by the state. And then the district gets to pick the curriculum to teach to those standards. This is the last graduation requirement we have that is not set at the state level. And I understand that every community is unique, just like every one of our students are unique. And our unique students across the state have been asking to have something that is more concise and comprehensive, just a baseline. So when kids move from one district to another, they know what to expect to graduate. And this is just a baseline, and we're setting it through the rulemaking process and making sure that we have a base of standardized requirements for health. Some kids in one school district might be getting the CPR. Some kids in other school district might not be. Some kids in one school district are getting taught about mental health. Even though it's in our statute, doesn't mean it's getting taught there. And the standards process around graduation requirements are important, so we have that baseline that we can expect when those kids get that diploma, we have an idea of what they've learned. So I just want to thank you for putting this in, because health is huge. Health is a huge part of everybody's life. It sets you up for success or failure depending on how early you learn about all those things. I would just had the Kidney Foundation was in a few, like last week already, and they were going through all the things that you need to do when you're younger so that your kidneys can stay healthy longer. Mm-hmm. And most of that I had never heard of. Part of that I was like, ooh, I think I already screwed that up. But it's just important for our kids to have all the information, beginning to have a healthy living later on. In fact, one last thing, really funny, my husband listened to an amazing podcast by a doctor about, I think the book was called Outlive. I couldn't stop him. He bought one copy for each of our kids, because it's all about setting up your life to be successful, healthy-wise, physical activity-wise, longevity-wise, and it starts when you're young. So this is really important, so thank you.
Thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll start with a question if I could.
Yes.
Representative Katiza Witun, just a quick question. So currently, for, we have all these areas the standards are required to cover, CPR, vaping, cannabis, and so on, the list here. Are there currently supports offered at the state level, such as model policy toolkits, guidance, state assistance for these areas? Do we know? Ms. Perry? I don't mean by law, if I can interject. It's, are those there? I don't know if anybody from the departments here that...
Madam Chair, Representative Bennett, there are some state resources. The mental health statute, for example, has, I believe it's the Department of Education or perhaps Health, gathering some resources for districts. And I believe the Department of Health has some vaping prevention materials. The cannabis bill from last year required the Department of Education to develop a model program for substance use prevention. Those are the ones that come to mind, but there may be others.
Thank you. Representative Bennett. Thanks, Madam Chair. I should have asked the knowledgeable person. You're knowledgeable, too, and say, but with the laws, thank you so much. I love having those two experts over there, don't you? So my thought is, and I'll just add some comments, that we're constantly, and it seems like more and more, mandating a state one-size-fits-all standards, models, whatever they are, onto our schools. Since we already have guidance, toolkits, model policy, why not beef those up? Give these general areas that need to be taught, which some of them already must be taught, and then let schools use that as a buffet of saying, okay, what best fits our community? Because as soon as we start to say, everybody must meet it this way, this standard, and especially in this area where there are, we merge into moral beliefs, religious beliefs, and all kinds of things like that that are different throughout our state, a little bit different than teaching math and whether we do, you know, addition, subtraction, algebra, and all those things. This is an area that especially should be local control, where our parents, our school boards, and that local process dictates how they want to see these fleshed out in their own communities. And it concerns me greatly because we are going to set up our schools like this in communities and start a lot of just a lot of struggles and stress that we don't need in our schools right now. So I understand the need for saying, you know, we need to teach in these areas, but I don't understand the need for one size fits all, these standards must be developed. And quite honestly, with the rulemaking process that was spoken about here, I'm not sure if I trust that process anymore. I used to think it was pretty unbiased and standardized, but the more I see what happened with the social studies standards in particular, where pretty much half the state was left out, and it's a group of, as far as I know, mostly appointed people, and yes, they're experts, but it's more and more being used to, in my mind, kind of weaponized for political purposes or political things into our curriculum, and that should not happen here. So I have issues with rulemaking process, especially in areas like this that are very sensitive locally. This should be local control. So thank you.
Thank you. And I will turn to you, Representative Katiza Witun, if you want to comment specifically or just begin your closing remarks.
Wonderful. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I so appreciate everybody's insight here today. I mean, I think that the start of this conversation is so important because, as some of our colleagues have mentioned, we know that we're not the experts, right? We have a principal here at the table. I've started having discussions with a variety of the different associations. Certainly I've met with Youth Prize and the Minnesota Youth Council directly. I've met with the Association of School Administrators and the elementary school and secondary school principals. We're still looking to schedule additional conversations just to gain insight, particularly from the local level and how our districts are handling the large amount of information that came at them in the last session. And in terms of timeline, I think that, you know, some of those conversations that we had, we know while it's in the language as after the end of the 25-26 school year or once the rulemaking process is ended, whichever is later. So I think making sure that our districts do have time to adjust to what they're instituting now currently, but then going forward, and that we continue to engage them in these conversations. So I think that we do recognize that the students all across Minnesota, no matter where they live, no matter where their classroom is, that health education enables them to understand and make well-informed decisions, not only about their own life, but how to support others around them. And adding health to the list of subject matters required to graduate for statewide standards can help us accomplish this. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, members, we will now vote to move House File 3682. With that, Representative Berg renews her motion to re-refer House File 3682 as amended to the Education Finance Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No?
No.
All right. Thank you. The motion carries. And House File 3682, as amended, is on its way to Education Finance. Thank you, Representative Katiza Witun.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the discussion today.
All right. And then we do have Representative Hassan is the next bill, 4363. Thank you, audience members. Well, Representative Hassan, we started the discussion, I think, of the gist of what your bill is, and we'll see how this kind of works into our other discussion of health standards. So our next bill, members, is House File 4363, and it's our intention to hear the bill and lay it over for further consideration and possible inclusion in a policy bill. And Representative Frazier, can you please motion House File 4363 to be before us?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And no amendment. All right. So we have the bill before us. If you could, thank you, Representative Hassan, for returning to your committee, and and please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is a very simple bill. I'm gonna say that, and I hope you guys don't make it complicated. it is a bill requiring mental health education to be included in the health education curriculum. Statute 120B-21 states that school districts and charter schools are encouraged to provide mental health instructions for students in grades 4 through 12 aligned with the local health standards and integrated into existing program curriculum or the general school environment of a district or charter school. And the only thing that we're changing is we're saying instead of encourage, mental health education must be included. And why do we need a bill like this? I'll give you some data. 42% of high school students in 2022 reported feeling sad or hopeless for at least two consecutive weeks in the previous year, that they stopped engaging in their usual activities. That's up from 26% in 2019. Girls and the LGBTQ plus young people particularly reported feeling those feelings more than others. Thoughts of suicide attempts, actual suicide among young people have also risen in that period, with black children nearly two times more likely than their white peers to die by suicide, according to the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention's biannual Youth Risk Behavior Survey and CDC stats. Depression and anxiety are among young people, are among very, what am I doing? Depression and anxiety, sorry guys, I've been presenting bills all day. Depression and anxiety among young people by some measures doubled since COVID, and still, those numbers are lingering. The American Psychology Association reported that we're facing national mental health crisis in our schools that could yield serious health and social consequences for years to come. And that, Madam Chair, is why we have this bill. And this bill comes from a young intern who was working with me over the summer, came to me and said that I see this problem. She is, I believe, she's a high school graduate. I think there's a video that we'll watch. And she said, I'm really worried about my peers. There's a lot of talks about anxiety and depression, more than what's common. And I at least know folks who are talking about suicide, or I hear about people who have attempted suicide or committed suicide. So what is our health standards when it comes to mental health? And I said, I don't know, let's look it together. And we look at it, and we saw that it's encouraged. The word encouraged doesn't mean that people have to do it. It's just that whoever wants to do it can do it. Whoever doesn't do it, there's no law that requires them to do that. So that is where this bill comes from, and I think it's befitting that we're just talking about health education standards. So I figured this will go well with including that in the health education reviews. And I believe, I don't know if I'm, if we have a video from, we'll watch the video and we'll stand for questions.
This will be our testimony.
I'm a senior at Egan High School, and I'm an intern under Representative Odom Hassan. I am testifying in support of House File 4363, a bill mandating mental health education in the state of Minnesota. Why is mental health important is a question that many people like to ask. As a student, juggling school, employment, and extracurricular activities can be a very hard task. Mental health is similar to physical health in that you need to know how to take care of yourself. School is the place that youth like me spend most. Hello, my name is Aisha Ibrahim.
It's 100%.
Yeah.
Hello, my name is Aisha Ibrahim. I'm a senior at Egan High School, and I'm an intern under Representative Odom Hassan. I am testifying in support of House File 4363, a bill mandating mental health education in the state of Minnesota. Why is mental health important is a question that many people like to ask. As a student, juggling school, employment, and extracurricular activities can be a very hard task. Mental health is similar to physical health in that you need to know how to take care of yourself. School is the place that youth like me spend most of their day in. It's a place where we deserve to feel as though we are supported, not only in our academics, but also mentally. Many mental illnesses are left untreated because people are not only uneducated about signs of mental illness, but there is a huge stigma surrounding mental health in our society. Students are suffering in silence because they don't know how to deal with their mental health issues or how to seek help. This bill mandating mental health education will allow for students to learn more about common mental health illnesses and increase the much needed conversation about mental health. It will allow for teachers to better support students and will further make youth feel as though they are in a more supportive, inclusive environment. Legislators, I urge you to support HF 4363.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative. I think now we will turn to member discussion and questions. Representative Baker.
Just one quick question. thank you for bringing the bill. Is there, and forgive me if I missed it, but is there a set amount of time that a school district has to provide this instruction? So is it embedded into the health class? Is it an assembly? Is it embedded into advisory class? Like, how do you see this instruction happening?
Representative Sutton.
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe that it will be embedded in health class education.
Mm-hmm. And currently, if it's embedded in the current standards for health class, if there were statewide health standards, then it would be embedded in those standards. But the beginning date is the 26th, 27th, that it's required.
Just one comment, then.
Representative Baker.
So I think whenever we mandate new classes, so if a district isn't doing something now, it's going to, there's only so many hours in the day, so then whether it's an elective or another requirement is going to be taken away from students. So I think student or school districts should be doing mental health instruction, but just, you know, and we had we've had different testifiers talk about the impact of mandating these things. It does impact elective options for students. So,
Representative Hassan, any comment?
Well, I believe this is important. If mental health wasn't important, if we didn't know that mental health was important, COVID hit and we realized that our students are suffering. I remember I was vice chair of Ed Policy during COVID, and the folks that were in Ed Finance, Ed Policy with me remember this. We had educators crying in our Zoom, you know, meetings, saying that we're overwhelmed, we're tired, we need help, and our students need help. So we really need to rethink the way that we think about mental health. And I think there's a whole lot of stigma and shame around mental health. That's why people don't talk about it. That's why people don't want a mental health diagnosis. But just like any physical ailment, mental illnesses are also another ailment, except it doesn't happen to our body, it happens to our mind. And if we teach our kids young age that it's okay when you feel depressed to go talk to somebody, it's okay, you can you know, have sad days and good days and bad days, if that's the way that we're raising our kids and you know, intertwining that with their education and embedding that in their life, they will know how to deal with stress when they grow up, instead of, you know, having a society that all depends on medication because we don't know how to deal with stress.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Lovett. I talked about it the last time. Addressing mental health is actually something we really need to do. Mine is more just a clarifying question. So in the last bill, when we talked about grades, we say like elementary, middle school, high school. And I know that that's been brought to my attention in some bills. In this bill, it says specifically grades 4 through 12. So I'm just wondering, like, how, not every school kind of has those same grade splits from elementary to middle school. I know, like, for fourth grade, fifth grade, that's still elementary for some schools. So can, it's more of just like a standardized question. When we do these requirements, do we break them down typically by grade like this, or do we typically break them down by like elementary, middle school, high school standards? Which I don't know if that's a question for you. I'm just seeing it show up in different ways, and I'm wondering how that plays out in our school systems.
Ms. Pera.
thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Keeler. It, I would say it varies for, so yes, so this has grades 4 through 12. I believe the CPR statute also has specific grades. In the standards, they are in bands. So for example, all the high school ones, I believe, are just like a block high school. So it varies both in the statutes that have specific requirements and in the standards.
Only made me more confused.
The current, like, but I mean, I add on the current statute, so 120B-21 does say currently this is four. The way that mm-hmm. it's written. I don't know who decided to divide these grades the way that they are, but if we need to maybe review it and say that this doesn't work for school districts, I mean, I'm open to the idea. But our current statute is written like this. That's what I'm
not a change in. Not in change in statutes in that part of it, just in the back, the date.
I understand. Taylor. Okay, thank you. That was when it was a suggestion, not a must. And so that's why I'm trying to, like, verify, like, if we make this something that schools need to do, mm-hmm. is it easier to implement in practice if the breakdown is middle school and high school versus that grade 4? That's the only thing I'm asking, and it's more just for implementation practical purposes moving forward with it. So that's
interesting. A good point to raise and something we should consider, and I will make a point of dealing with that. Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hassan. It is an important subject. I'm just curious if you have heard of something, and I'm not a psychologist or psychiatrist, I will just say that right up front. Had a little of education as a teacher in psychology, but there's something called the prevalence inflation hypothesis, and I just want to bring this out for you to look into as you're looking at this. The only reason I'm aware of it is I was looking into some mental health counseling and issues for a friend, and learned about this, that when we focus too much on mental health issues, there's a balance. There's increased awareness efforts, and then, but there, with that becomes improved recognition and overinterpretation. What happens is we focus on it so much, and especially with young people, that they start recognizing small mental health things that we all deal with daily, and hopefully we have fairly stable mental health brains here, but it overinflates these things and turns them into mental health problems. And I just would encourage you to look into that, because from my little understanding I have on this, there is a point where when we focus on mental health, it becomes actually counterproductive. And I heard that from a therapist who said, we only recommend this amount of time per week for therapy, because an increasing amount of data is showing that it becomes counterproductive and makes things worse. So I'm just throwing that out there, and not a criticism of your bill at all, but I will echo the another mandate issue. There are so many important things. Mental health is one, no argument there. But honestly, Madam Chair, I think we're going to need to have a bill to increase the number of hours we have in the school day, because at some point, schools aren't going to have enough time, and maybe they're just going to need to have bunk beds there. And I'm being sarcastic here, but kind of serious too, and just keep the kids overnight, because at what point are we forcing so much on schools that there's no longer time to teach everything? And it's really hard. I remember that as a teacher, trying to cram things into the day. So I think we have very important subjects, but we have to figure out how that balance works. Thank you.
Closing comments from Senator.
Madam Chair and members, I'll say on the record, I am a mental health clinician. So I don't think, if you ask me, I don't think we focus mental health enough. And if we did focus mental health enough, we wouldn't have the problems that we have with our young people not understanding how to deal with simple stress and how to differentiate when they're, depressed versus when they're sad versus when they need clinically to be seen by somebody. Thank you for the lively discussion. I extremely believe that mental health is important, because you can learn all the math in the world that you want. If you're not emotionally healthy, that math and science and technology won't get you anywhere. So we gotta raise children who are emotionally, physically, and spiritually healthy. And if we're gonna do that, we need to increase mental health awareness. Health is one of the subjects that's, in our school curriculum. And focusing, a little bit and intertwining a little bit of mental health and saying that, hey, let's talk about depression, let's talk about, anxiety, let's talk about, when to seek services, when to talk to somebody, doesn't take away from math or science or technology or history or social studies. With that, Madam Chair, I know the bill is being laid over, and I'm open to suggestions on how to make it better. Thank you for your time, and thank you for the discussion. I hope you can support.
Thank you for being with us and bringing forward your bill. And with that, Representative Frazier renews his motion to lay over House File 4363 for further consideration and possible conclusion and a policy bill. Thank you, Representative Hassan, for being with us. All right. We move on, and we have Representative Hewitt and House File 4008. We just always like to have you back, Representative Hewitt.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize to the committee up front. This is a controversial bill. We'll be spending a lot of time on it today, so we'll move quickly through it, hopefully.
All right. So we have House File 4008, and it's our intention to re-refer this bill to the Education Finance Committee because of, is that right? Am I on the right? That we're going to finance? There's a cost. There is a cost. So, yes, to re-refer it to the Education Finance Committee. And Representative Lee, can you motion House File 40-08 before the committee to be referred.
That is my motion.
Thank you, Representative Lee. All right.
I think there's an amendment.
The bill before us, and we also have an A1 amendment. And any, just, it's just.
Bring it in.
Is it the A1 amendment? It sounds like.
It just brings in the athletic trainers that are really important.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Representative Hewitt. So if we can have a motion for the A1 amendment.
I move for adoption of the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Representative Lee. All right. Discussion of the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. Seeing no discussion, all in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? All right. The A1 amendment is adopted. And please begin your presentation, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members. Real quickly, we'll go through this, that almost a half a million people a year, I'm sorry, almost 356,000 people a year have cardiac arrests outside a hospital. 90% of them are fatal. What this bill basically does is talk about our schools and what we want to do in our schools to change that. As an official, as an athletic official, and as somebody that hangs out a lot with the high school athletes, this is getting to be an ongoing problem. 23,000 children a year under the age of 18 experience cardiac arrest, and most 40% of them are athletic related. The SERP, which is the a plan that we're presenting today, that basically will require schools to come up with a cardiac response plan. Why we don't have these yet is surprising, because you go into a school and there is a plan for the fire extinguisher. I mean, I got a principal looking at me right now saying, yeah, there's a plan for everything. This is getting to be just as important as that fire extinguisher, and I think we got to move forward and come up with plans in our district, and this kind of lays that out for us. I'm going to turn it over to the testifier here real quick, and he can kind of go into it a little bit more in detail, if that's okay, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. If you could introduce yourself and begin with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Pryor, members of the House Education Policy Committee. I'm Paul Wirtz, State Government Relations Director for the American Heart Association here in Minnesota. I appreciate the opportunity to express the American Heart Association's support for House File 4008, legislation that will require school districts and charter schools to develop a cardiac emergency response plan. Sudden cardiac arrest is the leading cause of sudden death in young athletes and most commonly occurs during or just after physical exertion while engaged in practice sessions, organized competition, or other sports activities. With only seconds to react and every minute crucial, having an appropriate plan in place during a sudden cardiac emergency can make a difference in survival. The American Heart Association is working to turn bystanders into lifesavers so that in the time of cardiac emergency, anyone, anywhere, is prepared and empowered to become a vital link in the chain of survival and provide CPR. That means ensuring that every school and athletic event and facility has a SERP plan in place and is working directly with local emergency service providers and others to integrate the SERP plan into the community's EMS responder protocols. The establishment of this plan will empower and train school personnel in providing life-saving care between the time when the victim collapses and emergency services arrive. Each minute following the sudden cardiac arrest, survival decreases. However, when treated with defibrillation within 3 to 5 minutes, survival rates increase 50 to 70%. With thousands of students enrolled in Minnesota's public schools and charter school systems, plus thousands of numerous staff, it's important for school facilities to have a plan in place to address cardiac arrest. These plans not only benefit the students and staff, but the number of community members, parents, and supporters that come to school for events or other meetings. We want to thank Representative Hewitt for sponsoring this legislation. Thank you to the committee for hearing this bill. Chair Pryor, I would like to, if I can, ask my colleague, Mr. Dale Wakasugi, to kind of share his personal experience with this and support for the bill.
Thank you. Please settle in, introduce yourself again, and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Pryor and members of the Minnesota State, Minnesota House Education Policy Committee. I am Dale Wakasugi, a heart attack, cardiac arrest, and stroke survivor. resident of Woodbury, Minnesota, a community advocate on behalf of the American Association, and owner of my AED and CPR solutions. I'm pleased to be here today to offer my support for House File 4008, legislation that would require school districts and charter schools to create a cardiac emergency response plans. And I suffered a heart attack in 1986 when I was 36 years old. I was a very active non-drinker, non-smoker, and played college baseball. In 2007, while refereeing a high school basketball game at Fridley High School, I suffered a cardiac arrest. One of my heroes that day was Lindsay Paradise, an 11th grader who knew how to perform CPR and used an AED from learning about it in her health class just a few weeks prior to that evening. When cardiac arrest occurs outside of the hospital, survival more than doubles when people nearby act by dialing 911, starting CPR, and using publicly accessible AEDs compared to waiting for emergency responders to arrive. I support House File 4008 because we need to ensure that all schools have cardiac emergency response plans in place and practice, so anyone who suffers a cardiac arrest, whether it be a student, teacher, school administrator, or members of the community, can receive the life-saving treatment they need. So I want to thank Representative Hewitt for authoring this important legislation, and thank you, Chair Pryor, and members of the committee for your consideration of this bill.
Thank you. Turn to member discussion. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Hewitt. See you a lot in committee. So here we are. I love this bill. I think this bill is really important. As a person with a congenital heart defect, I know how important it is for us to have people who know what they're doing when a cardiac emergency happens. And it just so happened in Austin that we had a young man who actually died from a cardiac event because we didn't know. And it was right after football practice and all the things. And so I know this was something that I was noodling in my head and couldn't quite figure out what to do next and how to do it. And so love that you beat me to it, as this is something that I'd like to do. And so, you know, it's when we talk about putting things that are in place for our schools to be successful, this is one of those things. So thank you. And thank you for your support, and we're just so appreciative that you made it through all their things and you're able to be here to support the bill. Thank you so much.
Well, I think we should close with that, but yeah. Representative Hewitt.
I'm really sick of our colleagues across the table stealing my closings because they've done it a couple times this year, but
you're welcome.
Representative Mueller done a great job. I can't say much more than Representative Mueller did, and I do have to say to my colleague sitting next to me, and he is truly one of my colleagues, he was a referee, first thing I do when I go to a game to ref it is, where is the AED? I'm 58 years old. That thing could be used on me. So seriously, this is really important. I like that the committee heard it. I look forward to going over to Chair Hume's division. So thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Any more comments?
I'm not going to take away from that, but I'm just going to say I'm thankful that we have another 10%er here. You made the 10%. Mr. Withers here 4 years ago had a cardiac arrest, and he's with us today. So, but there are 90% that don't make it. So important. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we feel that very much, this personal testimony. Thank you. Thank you for bringing the bill before us, and and now we'll take a vote.
Get the vote out.
All right. And with that, Representative Lee renews her motion to re-refer House File 4008 as amended to the Education Finance Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries, and House File 4008 as amended is on its way to Education Finance. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Thank you for being here. All right, we will now return to a bill that we started yesterday. That was just yesterday. And we heard some great testimony, but I think that we did not have time to really understand the bill. So that is House File 3372, Representative Clardy. if you can come down again, and we can begin them with our questions and discussion. I guess what I need to do is bring House File 3372 before us again for discussion. And then it is intent after discussion to re-refer the bill to Education Finance will be the motion. And it was originally Representative Frazier's motion. So I think the bill is before us again. And I think that if Representative Clardy, if you could just give us maybe a couple bullet points of the highlights of the bill, we can start, members can bring us forward for discussion, the main elements of the bill that we heard testimony on yesterday.
All right. So what we're looking at is that the EL students are the fastest growing geographical growing population. The things that we're looking at is to establish micro-credentialing pathway for existing licensed teachers and administrators to grow their competency in serving EL students. We are also looking at EL students' additional support in the ALCs, because there's a lack there. And then also establishing a task force at MDE to inform the legislature of what resources would be needed to fully fund ELL learner programs in like the ELCs and what the best practices are.
Thank you for that summary. And I'm going to ask a question at this point. I don't have a clear picture of what micro-credentialing is, and I think that that's an important aspect of the bill, and perhaps if we can go on a discussion or a brief description of what that means and how this bill would advance that.
Madam Chair?
Yes, if you can identify yourself.
Yes, of course. Proceed. My name is Leotawa Dr. John Peterson, and I am the Senior Policy Fellow with the Minnesota Education Equity Partnership. Great to be back here with you all today. Micro-credentialing takes different forms depending on the state. I think California was one of the first states to adopt micro-credentialing. Essentially what it is it's providing licensed teachers in areas other than ESL with an opportunity to learn more about the best practices and promising practices for working with English learners. And so a case example would be the Southeast Service Cooperative in southeastern Minnesota received a federal grant about a year and a half ago to provide for training for teachers who are not ESL teachers to do exactly that, some of the best practices, promising practices, how to provide co-taught and co-planned instruction in ways that better serve English learners. And so that would be kind of just the nuts and bolts of the micro-credentialing piece. I will say it's not a proxy for a license, and we're not intending that it be a proxy for a license in any way. In terms of the bill language, the micro-credentialing actually goes two different directions. One, it provides for micro-credentialing for content area teachers in the area of ESL, but it also provides for micro-credentialing in the area for ESL teachers in content area courses. So like, for example, if I were an ESL teacher, I'd have an opportunity to earn a micro-credential in Broadfield Social Studies. The basis of that, and I'll wrap this up, is so that when we co-plan and co-teach together, maybe you're the social studies teacher and I'm the ESL teacher, we both speak the same language. I speak a little bit of Broadfield Social Studies, you speak a little bit of ESL, and we can better serve English learners and all students in the classroom.
And we are having a little discussion that we don't have the amendment in our packets right now. Yeah. It's not. Yeah, and if we had it yesterday and then it was not put in again, if you saved it, you have it. And we can. So I think the gist of it is we don't all have access to
show
you.
Madam Chair, I think it is still posted too, but just
still,
if
yeah.
people need.
So paper. So members, if you would like to look at the bill was amended. And so it is the bill as amended that we're discussing right now. And it's probably, there's not a new copy or there was yesterday, but there's not a copy in the packet again today, but it is posted. If you have any specific questions, you can we can get access to it that way. So thank you. And thank you for the description of micro-credentialing, and if I can follow up with that too, is it currently we do not have any micro-credentialing, and so this would be a beginning of a new or kind of a creation of a new kind of credentialing, I guess, is what we would describe that does not currently exist. And I'm seeing a nodding of yes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, we do not have micro-credentialing as an option here in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. I want to stress that this would be a voluntary micro-credential. It is not a mandate. And so it would be an opportunity for teachers who are interested in participating in a program like Project Momentum to earn a micro-credential that would be then hopefully transcripted onto their license that identifies them as having, you know, an additional 8, 9, 10, 12 credits in ESL or a broad field social studies or science or math area to be a more effective teacher in working with English learners.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Are there member questions and discussions? Chair Joaquin.
Thank you, Chair Pryor, and thank you for explaining the micro-credentialing. I'm very excited about that personally. Our son's getting a master's in literacy, and I was trying to get him to do a master's in EL, but it'd be something that is that option for teachers to go get that extra micro-credential so they can better serve their students. So thank you.
Representative Bennett. All right. Appreciate for this discussion that we've had on this bill. And with that, we will, we'll renew the motion to re-refer House File 3546 as amended to Education Finance. All in favor? It's 3372, excuse me. 3372, sorry, there's a lot of bills today. House File 3372 as amended to be re-referred to Education Finance. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Right. The ayes have it. And 3372 as amended is on its way to Education Finance. Thanks for returning today and continuing that clarification and discussion. We do appreciate that. All right. All right, so I think that we do have time to continue on and bring up again another bill that we started yesterday. If you give me a moment to reorientate myself. So it's House File 4611, and I'll have Representative Hill take over for 4611.
Well, as you get settled, Chair Pryor, our next bill for consideration was also introduced with testimony yesterday. It is House File 4611. Members, it's our intention to discuss the bill before laying it over for further consideration or possible inclusion in a policy bill. Representative Pryor, Chair Pryor, can you please re-motion House File 4611 before us to lay it over for further consideration or possible inclusion in the policy bill?
So moved.
Would you like to help us revisit?
Thank you. All right. So House File 4611 was brought to us from the Metropolitan Library Service Agency, which is more commonly known as MELSA. People use that acronym. I have not heard of it before. But this organization is one of 12 regional library systems in Minnesota. And like other regional library systems, MELSA provides training, education, and programming for the Metro Library regions. However, unlike the other regional library systems, MELSA does not administer libraries. That responsibility is left to each metro county and their library directors. Because of this key difference, the executive leadership of the MELSA requires a different skill set. MELSA is currently working to hire a new executive director and is committed to recruiting a talented and diverse pool of candidates. However, the hiring requirements and state rules require that all regional library executives hold an MLS degree. As the MELSA director does not run libraries, MELSA requests to be exempted from this rule in order to attract a large and diverse pool of applicants to the position. So essentially that's what we're asking, is the exemption of that master level in library science to be able to hold this position. And as members remember yesterday, there is opposition to it. So it is a bill that is under discussion right now. And we're trying to navigate, you know, what's the, if it's something that should be included in a final policy bill or not. But I think it is part of this general discussion of whether or not, you know, what's the appropriate level of education for any position and if we should be dictating that in statute. And if this is a situation where, just as the governor at one point had said that positions that before had required a college degree, they realize now can be filled by people with associate degrees and other backgrounds experience, and that we no longer require college degrees for many jobs that we did in the past. Because also of the difference between the being the executive position of this particular organization versus having a similar position at a county library, that masters of the of library science is not the same level of requirement and need as other skills are. So that was the idea of bringing this forward. Love to hear member comments and maybe not so much questions. I can get back with answers, but comments and perspectives on that.
Thank you, Chair Pryor. We'll open it up for discussion. Chair Youakim.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe just a question you can bring back to the stakeholders as you talk about this. I know that MDE had made some comments about a federal grant being able to come in unless there's a licensed librarian. Well, there are still at each of these MELSA libraries. The executive, that you know, the executive director just runs it as an umbrella organization. So that was confusing to me. Plus, I think folks have been asking for that specific notation to be pointed to in statute, and no one can seem to do that. So maybe just bring that back to MDE when you talk to them about, okay, you say it says this, but where would be nice.
Thank you, Chair Youakim. Response? Chair Pryor?
I think that's a really interesting question. I was I would be interested in the answer too. So I think that should be part of the ongoing discussion about the further consideration that we're taking this bill as.
Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I did have a question, but I'll pose it as more of a thought to bring back. And I appreciate the ongoing discussion way that this is being handled to try to make sure that we get full understanding before it becomes law. But so my first thought when I saw this was, why would we be carving out one library system? Mm-hmm. Why not just the whole state? Because to be a master's degree is either valuable for this or not. But it sounds like there are some intricacies I'm hearing that Rep. Youakim and maybe you had said too. So I'm just throwing that out. You don't even need to answer it, I guess, unless you know the answer as to what's different from this and why not just the whole state or not the whole state. I'm not going to argue. I don't know whether a master's degree is really important for this or not. So, mm-hmm.
Right. So we, thinking about that and processing it as, you know, finding out that we as an education policy committee and education finance are responsible for libraries and we need to learn more about them. And I think that's an excellent thought of, and I think part of the discussion was along the lines that you're thinking now and that I was also thinking when the bill was first brought to me, is that what's the difference between this particular position within this particular organization, and that it's that the master degree is not as essential to, you know, it's valuable, but it's not as essential, and not necessarily a disqualifying plaque of would not be disqualifying for this organization versus the other ways that other levels or organizations for library system. So, and whether or not the master's degree. So I think that's the case that has to be made, is that in the further discussion that I will take back to the people that I'm talking with and working with to decide on this and the feasibility of it. So a very, very good avenue to pursue and to have completely clarified before we know that this is the right way forward.
Any follow-up, Lee Bennett? And Representative Lee, did you have a question? I thought we saw a signal there.
Yeah, I guess question and maybe also thoughts on bringing things back. I did also want to just add color to this, that the language here is permissive, and so, you know, folks with master's degrees can still apply, but the way I understand it is we also have a workforce shortage amongst librarians, and so understand the need for, you know, skilled librarians to get people the information they need, but a lot of people have also been exiting the library profession, which is not great, and so I understand why in this piece, and I also don't want to confuse folks, because this position is, I think, my understanding, a little bit more clerical and administrative and not directly serving libraries, so don't want to confuse folks about that, but I think part of what's driving this is probably also just this workforce issue.
Thank you for that comment.
Thank you. Closing comments, Chair Pryor.
Nope, but this is still a work. You can tell by the bill number 4611 that it's a new bill that's been introduced, and there's definitely some work that needs to be done on further clarification before deciding whether or not this is something that we should be putting forward as statute.
Thank you. And with that, Chair Pryor renews her motion to lay over House File 4611 for further consideration. And with the first half of our agenda complete,
recess.
We're going to go into recess. We'll reconvene here at 6 o'clock.
All right. Welcome back. We're here for part two, and we have some additional bills that we'll be hearing this evening. So I am reconvening Education Policy Committee. And we have up, ready to go, to our first bill of the evening, House File 4083, Representative Chair Joachim. We will consider this bill also for including in a final policy bill, but we also will be entertaining a motion to send this bill to the General Register. And so we'll be taking a vote on that. So we'll begin by moving the bill before. So, Chair Joachim, would you please motion House File 4083 before the committee to be re-referred to the General Register?
Chair Breyer, that is my motion, and I also have an A2 amendment.
All right, and if you, any mention of the A2 amendment, and then we'll approve the A2.
The A2 amendment reflects the discussions that I've been having with MSPA and the Principals Association to meet some of their concerns.
Okay, all right, thank you. All right, so Chair Joachim moves the A2 amendment. Any discussion of the A2? All right, all in favor of the A2, please say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right, the A2 amendment is adopted. And Chair, please begin your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Pryor, and I'd like to thank the co-authors on this bill, especially Representative Erdahl, who I was hoping would be here tonight. He's been with me on this bill for almost every step of the way. I started working on this bill in 2017 when a group of journalism teachers and students approached me and asked to bring forward this important issue. While did not get a hearing that year, we did pass it out of the House in 2020, and we're back here again today because it is more important than ever before for our students to learn media literacy, the standards of objective journalism, and critical thinking. We need this bill because we are living in a day and age of instant mass media where the art of objective journalism is being lost and critical thinking has gone by the wayside in 280 characters or less. Students need to learn how to think and communicate critically and effectively wherever their career path or high school after high school takes them. To do this, they need to be able to practice. And what safer place to practice in a controlled environment of a school under the supervision of a trained media advisor and without the fear of complete censorship stifling their passion to learn? Members, there's a reason why the press is considered the fourth branch of government. It helps to shape our democracy and to keep it honest. That is one of the reasons why I went to school for journalism, that and the inspiration of Edward R. Murrow. Teaching journalism in our secondary schools also helps to prepare our future leaders to be civically engaged. But some of our students are not getting that opportunity. Their voices and thoughts are hushed before they're even given a chance to take flight. They are self-censoring for fear of not being able to publish. And a few over the years have been outright censored by their districts. I would also argue that this bill gives much needed clarity to school administration on when and when they cannot censor a student journalist in something to point to in statute. This bill defines school-sponsored media, school officials, student journalists, and student media advisors in Subdivision 1. In Subdivision 2, you'll see what is protected conduct of a student journalist. You will see defined what is unprotected speech in Subdivision 3. And in Subdivision 4 is the requirement for schools to adopt a student journalism policy. I want to draw your attention to Subdivision 3 because this is what is where the districts are allowed to have authorized prior restraint on a student journalist. And this is unprotected speech. If you look in Subdivision 3, and I know it's really long day, it's been a long day for everybody, so I'll just read them really quickly. If speech is defamatory, is profane, harassing, threatening, or intimidating, constitutes an unwarranted invasion of privacy, so signals out a child, student, or a teacher too much, violates federal or state law, causes a material and substantial disruption of school activities, or is directed to inciting or producing imminent lawless action on school premise, or the violation of lawful school policies or rules, including a policy adopted in accordance with the sections in 128.03 and 031, which is our student bullying policy. So members, those are the areas where as you see with the amendments, a school district must not authorize any prior restraint of school-sponsored media except under Subdivision 3. So those are the unprotected expressions for our student journalists. And it follows along the Supreme Court state case in Tinker, which some of the testifiers will be talking about later today. There have been 16 states where similar language has become law for high school journalists over the last decade. Washington, Oregon, Nevada, California, Colorado, Kansas, North Dakota, Iowa, Illinois, Arkansas, Vermont, New Jersey, Maine, Rhode Island, Maryland, and Hawaii. They have charted the way, and it's time for Minnesota to catch up. But you've heard enough from me. I want to like to turn the testimony over to the real experts in the room, the students and their teachers, and you also have written letters of support in your packets as well.
All right, first up I have Jeff Burker, Publications Advisors from Hopkins High School. And then Jessica Wagner, I believe you're on deck and appreciate that. And you can introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Pryor. Members, my name is Jeff Coker. I'm a journalism advisor, publications advisor at Hopkins High School. I have advised media at Hopkins for the last 23 years. I'm a Dow Jones News Fellow, a former Minnesota State Journalism Teacher of the Year, and I hold a master's in journalism and education. And I want to thank you and thank Representative Joachim for agreeing to address this issue to protect student freedoms in the classroom. As she mentioned, this is not a new issue. It's something that we have discussed in our state before. It's something that we are following other states. And there are several states that have had this in place since the 1980s. And you'll see them operating successfully. We hear the virtue of freedom used in much of our political discourse, and it's held up as one of the hallmarks of our democracy. It's in our politics, it's embedded in social studies standards as we study the fight for freedom up to and including the battles that we wage today. It's a standard that we must teach about these freedoms and the government's role in protecting those freedoms through classes on both citizenship and government. This year in Minnesota, we have a real opportunity to join these 16 other states to create an environment that actually allows for the robust application of these lessons and these principles that are part of our state standards. House File 4083 will help protect student voices and engage them in a civic democracy. I've worked alongside student journalists at Hopkins High School for the past 23 years. I've seen the world they try to navigate as student journalists. They faced obstacles in getting accurate information or even responses from the district or the government. They face pressure from their peers to not publish stories. They face scrutiny after a story is published and are accused of making up quotes, even though they have recordings of the interviews to show quotes are accurately represented. And over my 23 years, they've navigated this minefield of obstacles, pressures, and threats with little guidance or help from the state. We can readily find standards and guidelines for how we teach civics, government, ethnic studies, science, and et cetera. We can find policies that protect kids from bullying, harassment, and discrimination. Those provide clarity for schools, students, and families as they try to navigate an increasingly complex world. Joining the 16 other states that have codified language protecting student expression in schools would provide the same clarity and guidance to both students and schools as they work to foster an environment that allows for the responsible practice of their civic rights and responsibilities. It's been my experience that when student journalists see issues in their schools, they want to talk about them. They want to foster a public discourse and make sure both sides are heard. In my 23 years, those issues have run the gamut of discussing the school lunches, of course, to illustrating the fight culture at our school, and digging into real publicly available data to compare us to neighboring communities. The freedom to do that led one of my former students on the path to being the current investigative award-winning reporter at the Pittsburgh Gazette, and he's still only in his 20s. In one of the most powerful stories my students have published, they discussed rape culture and its face at our school through social media. They persevered in publishing the story through pressure from their peers who might have been culpable of perpetuating a rape culture, parents of those peers, and admin who didn't want the bad publicity such a story might bring. In the end, they were minutes away from uploading to the printer when our district administrator called with a stand down from the censorship and a clear, albeit belated, support of their First Amendment rights. And as we hope happens in a journalistically sound story, the only outcome of laying bare the rape culture at our school was that the specific instances we highlighted were called up by experts and those behaviors stopped. Schools should be celebrated for fostering student press rights, like my school eventually did in this instance. Our students should be celebrated for having the courage to write truthfully about issues amidst peer, faculty, and admin pressure. What was laid bare, though, is my students sat in a room with the school district's lawyer and fought for their First Amendment rights with their own representation. Without their own representation, was that the state does not provide the necessary clarity and guardrails for students and schools. What would have been so very helpful was something to point to in state statute or policy that helped us support student voice and understand the limitations imposed upon them. I encourage you to move House File 4083 forward and join the 16 other states, including Iowa and North Dakota, and hopefully soon Wisconsin, in codifying and providing clarity for schools and student journalists as they exercise their most important civic right, their voices. Thank you again for the opportunity to be here tonight, and we look forward to the passage of this bill.
Thank you. Jessica Wagner. And then after that, it will be Stella McHugh, if you can be ready.
Good
Please
evening.
Introduce yourself and proceed.
I'm Jessica Wagner, and I am an English teacher at Owatonna High School for the last 22 years, and I have been the advisor of the student-run newspaper OHS Magnet for the last 10. I thank you tonight for letting me come and speak to you about New Voices and its potential impact for publications in our school. School newspapers are tasked with telling the stories of our community. More importantly, it provides an essential space where students can voice concerns to enlighten others and solve problems. Journalism is a powerful and necessary component to the health of every school. Students must be able to tell the stories that are important to them and are not just good press for the school district. This comes with great responsibility to journalism ethics. The Supreme Court decision on Hazelwood and versus Coleman sounds like it is making sure kids aren't writing false allegations poorly. However, it is essentially placing student journalists in the spot of being the school's public relations team, or potentially fighting for every story if an administrator wants to review it before it is published. Thankfully, we've had a lot of good news to also broadcast. This current issue is that questioning a process is often seen as questioning an authority depending on the administration. A school newspaper is subject to budget cuts in an attempt to silence the articles under the disguise of cost savings. When we are silencing student reporters, oftentimes we are silencing the stories of the disenfranchised. This is played out in our newsroom. In the case of an editorial, my staff members who are also athletes were worried about losing their position if the activity director read it. After an accurate article about discipline, I was told to only shine a positive light. A few months later, when the school went to lockdown and law enforcement was called to handle the situation,
I knew I would only be allowed to remain advisor if we did not report the story. Student journalists are not free of consequence from their speech, but we should not be punished for reporting events that happen in our building and to our students. At the time, I had to decide if it was worth the future of student journalism at Owatonna High School, and if I was willing to be fired from my advisor role over it. Social media told the story. We were able to report the information with what we had nearly a month after the incident. Over the summer, the New York Times told the story of our students. While new administration has welcomed and celebrated OHS Magnet, which is evident by the fact that I'm here tonight, free press in the school shouldn't be dependent on a change in the principal or the superintendent's office. This is a problem in Minnesota as well as across the nation. I'm hopeful as I speak to you tonight for student journalists and for those hired to teach them to have the protection of the First Amendment right, because a freedom is not, it is not a freedom if it is under review or you have to ask permission. Students become leaders when they are taught the power of responsibility that comes with reporting events and stories with integrity, without fear of censorship or review. These are the students who help solve problems and to polarize our culture. By modeling integrity in our publications, their readers learn media literacy and civic engagement. I believe by passing this legislation, all students will have a chance to be heard. I thank you for your time tonight.
Thank you.
Chair Pryor, can I just interject real quick? I just want to thank the students for being here tonight. It's a nice night, and I know they have work, probably homework to do when they get home. And having two Stillwater High School students here means a lot to me, because I used to write for the Pony Express when I went to Stillwater. And I want to also thank Yoni Zax for being here from Blake School. Why this bill does not cover private schools. He is here to support his public school journalists and hopefully have this in statute so they can approach their school about this. So I just wanted to interject that here. Thank you.
Thank you. And we second the thanks for being with us tonight. Stella McHugh, Pony Express Editor-in-Chief. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Hi, thank you. My name is Stella McHugh. I'm a senior at Stillwater Area High School, and I have been a journalist for the Pony Express for 2 years, and I'm currently Editor-in-Chief. The current Minnesota legislation under the 1988 Supreme Court case Hazelwood versus Kuhlmeier states that school administration can censor school-sponsored media when reasonably related to legitimate concerns. This vague standard allows administrators to engage in subjective and arbitrary censorship without an articulable pedagogical concern. Stories censored are often sensitive issues, such as stories critical of administration or covering topics such as the LGBTQ plus community. Returning Minnesota to the previous Tinker standards will allow students full First Amendment rights while still maintaining lawful oversight of students and preventing libelous material from being published. My team of EICs recently wrote an article about racial tensions within our school, an issue that was sensitive but necessary to cover. We were hesitant to write the story due to the harsh reality that it would bring to our staff, the same staff that had the ability to censor the story. We spent weeks arguing over every sentence, every word, wondering if it would be too controversial to publish and if it would be censored. Without more protection at the state level, redefining these case precedents and supporting student press, then students will continue to be fearful of using school-sponsored media to discuss important issues because they fear that they will be censored. This fear is also known as the chilling effect, or putting a chill on students' expression and willingness to cover sensitive topics, effectively limiting students' voices. This goes against the decision in Tinker that students don't shed their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse gate. We need legislation that will allow us to honestly inform and educate the community on things that matter, free from fear and unjust censorship. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, I have Bella Lapos, and after that, Yoni Zax.
Hello. Thank you. My name is Belle Lapis. I'm a senior at Stillwater Area High School and have been a part of our school publication, The Pony Express, for 2 years. I'm now an editor-in-chief helping to oversee the program. Freedom of expression through school-sponsored media is a fundamental principle granted by the First Amendment of the Constitution. As an editor-in-chief and student leader, my job is to decide what stories our journalists write and publish. Because of the fear of censorship instilled by the court case Hazelwood versus Kuhlmeier, students cannot truly express their opinions and write articles reflecting their passions and conversations happening within the community. Critical thinking and open conversations are often censored out of fear. Recently, our publication wrote a series of articles reflecting upon concerns of racial violence and changes in our community that students expressed. To publish these articles, we felt we had to put the school into a good light to ensure that we could reflect opinions without censorship. This ultimately silenced many of the interviewed students. Unfortunately, many schools in the state haven't been lucky enough to publish stories deemed too controversial, often leading to full censorship of the story and even shutting down publications. With this bill, the Tinker Standard is restored for all students. It will serve as a way for students to express their opinions while still allowing school officials to stop publication of student media in certain cases. From our experience, most students are in journalism to express themselves and give a voice to the student body and experiences. It is a platform for concerns, stories, and perspectives to be acknowledged. To date, the Student Press Law Center is aware of no reported court decision where a school district has been held liable for material published by its high school student media in the 16 states with this legislation. The role of a student publication is to express legitimate information and to inform and educate the community about things that matter. This bill will protect us in doing so. Thank you.
Thank you. Bonnie Sachs, please introduce yourself and proceed, and then I have Dr. Terrence Morrow.
Good evening. My name is Yoni Zaks. I am a junior at the Blake School in Minneapolis, and I have been on our newspaper. I've worked on our newspaper, The Spectrum, for 3 years, and I am currently a managing editor. Student press freedoms are extremely important to me. School newspapers have given me and thousands of others the opportunity to have our voices heard and to tell the stories that need to be told. We have a responsibility to always be honest and always tell stories. By expanding these student press protections, students will be able to provide a forum for student opinions and cover the issues that really need to be addressed. There have been times in the past when our school has collectively experienced issues that need to be addressed. 2 years ago, when our school had an assembly that left a large majority of the student body uncomfortable, our editorial staff put the article on the front page. This gave students the opportunity to voice their concerns and to the administration without the fear of repercussions. As a staff writer at the time, I was impressed by the in-depth critiques of the administration and the fact that they were able to publish this article in the first place. However, I was also concerned about repercussions from the administrators named in the article. At the time of reading it, I vividly remember thinking, this is a great article, but what's going to happen to the writer? And then at the end of October, when the other news editors and I felt like the community wasn't talking about the Israel-Hamas war, and this created an environment where students were afraid of repercussions for what they would say in class, we decided as a staff that the best way to cover the war was to ask community members how they thought we should discuss the conflict. As a newspaper, we felt a responsibility to adhere to our mission statement and inform our readers and provide a forum for opinions. After publishing that piece, the editorial staff decided to move forward with covering the war by doing an in-depth spread. We published a timeline, a list of resources, a survey, a Q&A, more student perspectives, and an article questioning how the student body had talked about this conflict. Before publishing this, I was incredibly anxious, as I had played a large role in the creation of this page, even coming up with the idea for it, and I was afraid that there would be repercussions for giving the space for students to share their opinions, not just from the administration, but also from other students. We believe that students should have a space to have their voices heard and to formulate perspectives without fear of repercussions, and where adults cannot have that space. Although this bill does not apply to me personally as a private school student, my hope is that if this bill is passed, private schools will follow, such as Blake, will follow suit. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. And finally, we have a public testifier, Dr. Terrence Morrow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Terry Morrow, Policy and Legal Services Director, Minnesota School Boards Association, recognizing I'm following some very difficult acts. You put me under pressure here. But I would like to say thank you, Representative. We have had a chance to talk about this bill. And I come here today to agree with the amendments that have been made to the bill. One concerned advertising. In the original bill, the school would have had to allow any advertising that the students chose. And we have advertising policies concerning materials that are unlawful for minors, for example. So I thank you for adding that. We can't run those ads. Secondly, and I really appreciate the discussion of Subdivision 3 on page 2, starting at line 2.20. In the Senate this morning, we were able to, or earlier this afternoon, we were able to clarify that the unprotected expression could be overseen by, for example, the Student Media Supervisor Online 2.2. We wanted to clarify that if there was an article that was defamatory, that did constitute an unwarranted invasion of privacy, that the school would be able to step in, hopefully in a teachable moment way, but nonetheless, to ensure that our policies or the law weren't violated by a publication. And with that, I have nothing further to add to this bill this time, other than to say thank you for working with us on this bill.
Thank you. And finally, I have Roger Arneson, Minnesota Association of Secondary School Principals.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Roger Arneson. I represent the Elementary and Secondary Principals Association, secondary principals here. I want to first off say that we deeply appreciate Chair Youakim's amendment to the bill that cured a major problem that we have, and I know that wasn't easy for her to do that, and that was a very good thing for us. We want to say a couple things just to be on the record about this for school principals. You heard a lot about Tinker versus Des Moines and the Hazelwood case. But the Hazelwood case is why we're here talking about this. Hazelwood occurred in 1983. It actually was a 1988 U.S. Supreme Court case. But in that, student journalists did an article about high school girls who were pregnant and how they navigated high school being pregnant. The journalists had promised the students confidentiality. The principal reviewed the article and said, I can tell who these kids are. So we're going to pull this article to protect those kids. That's what Hazelwood was about. The newspaper kids sued and said, we have a First Amendment right to print this. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, actually, no, you don't. If the school district is the, quote, publisher of that paper and it's being run as a class, then the school can say there are some things that don't go in the paper. Now, you've heard from very talented students, very compelling testimony. We would submit to you as a school principals that school newspapers are working quite well in Minnesota and have done so for a long time. If you Googled the Eden Prairie paper, if you Googled the Hopkins paper, you would see that these have controversial articles, they do the in-depth work, and that they're good learning places for students. But principals will never come in here and tell you that we think supervision is unnecessary. We always think supervision is necessary. We just can't get away with that. And what we want to do without that, and what we want to do is that we like to say kids do better with some supervision and give them the opportunity to do better. So I think that we know that Chair Youakim's heart is in the right place and supporting these people. We frankly are rarely on the other side of the coin with her. It is uncomfortable to be in that position here today. I don't like it. But I do have to come up and say that for the folks. So we appreciate working with her, and Madam Chair, appreciate working with the committee. So thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, having no more testifiers, we'll go to discussion. Yes.
No, thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm just disappointed that Mr. Aronson never said that I regret being on the opposite side of Representative Erdahl. There were a couple of issues over the years, but we've generally reached accommodations. You know, I was a school newspaper reporter back. They actually did have typewriters and things when I was there. And in our system in Litchfield High School, look for the Dragon News. Our supervisor was, you know, the teacher in charge of the journalism class. And in terms of censorship, worked very well. He would just come by, read my articles, and say, you can't do that. He was generally right, so I didn't question him very much. But, you know, I think that's probably the way it still works across Minnesota, that writers, student writers, their advisor, their journalism teacher, whatever, is the first censor, essentially. And that, I think, probably works pretty well. If they're but I'm generally, you know, in agreement with the basis of this bill as far as how it is intended to work. I think, you know, freedom of speech is an important quality. There should be some guardrails, and I'm glad to see that through the amendments there are some of those being placed. But, you know, generally over the years, the system, I think, has worked fairly well, and look forward to seeing how this shakes out. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank Representative Joachim for bringing this bill. As a former board member of the ACLU of Minnesota for a while and a big fan of Tinker v. Des Moines, any bill that inspires us to quote that great quote about our constitutional rights not ending at the schoolhouse gate is an important bill for us to advance. So thank you so much for this really important free speech bill. And thanks to the students.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair Joachim, for this. I do really think it's important for students to be able to share what's happening in their perspective. But mainly, I just wanted to say thank you to the students that came. You were well prepared. You did a great job. And I think when we have our next generation stand up for something that they want to see, it's important that us as adults at this table really listen to that. So thank you for taking the time. I'm sure nobody wants to be here. Well, whatever time it is on whatever day it is right now, right? But, like, thank you for coming. Thank you for being a part of this. Thank you for including the youth in this work.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Joachim. And I would echo what Rep. Keeler talked about. Students, you did a fantastic job. I would say you did a much better job than the adults that testified. But so I might be a little biased there, though. So. And I think just a couple comments. So the completely agree that we need to teach kids how to have dialogue with people that have a different perspective than us. So I think it's phenomenal, and the more we do that, the better off we're going to be, because frankly, we don't do that well as adults. And I think Chair Joachim talked about it in you know, with these and, you know, trying to get tweets and likes, you know, having constructive dialogue doesn't play into that well. And, you know, we talked about Tinker, we talked about Hazelwood, so I won't go into that. But I think just from a principal lens and from an educator lens, one of the things that there's always this tension of trying to teach kids how to have constructive dialogue and teach them how to kind of push the envelope while also not putting them in a situation where they're going to make a mistake that could really impact them for a long time. So I had my son was showing me some bar stool pages. For those of you that don't know, Representative Frazier knows where I'm going with this. There are some things that are said on some of these pages online that are highly inappropriate, but to a high school kid, very funny. Yes. And then you fast forward that out to when that child is applying for a job. It can have damaging effects for that student. So I think that's the tension that principals are trying to navigate, is how do I teach these kids without you know, stifling their First Amendment rights, which we don't want to do that, but also not setting them up for failure long term. So with that, I think, you know, we just need to continue to work together and partner with everyone involved to how do we balance that tension.
Thank you, Representative Baker. Okay, Representative Bennett.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And Chair Joachim, what a great conversation. This is good. And thank you to the students. They're all, I think, a lot behind me, but I loved hearing that passion and the discussion. And I think all the comments are excellent all around this table. And I guess I'll just express my one concern, which would be very similar to Representative Bakeberg, is in the end, and I taught first grade, so I taught the other end of the spectrum. We didn't have student newspapers in first grade. But in the end, they are still children, adolescents with developing brains, and we have to be very careful to allow freedom, but also within constraint. And so one, I guess the one thing I would like to see in this bill, and it probably defeats the purpose, but there should be some kind of a final veto allowed to protect things like Rep. Baker said, where you get something online, social media is forever now, and the internet, that would really harm a student in the future. And so I just think it needs a little more discussion in that area. We're dealing with developing brains that need guidance. We do a lot of guidance. We don't let young people join the military or get married or own a gun or even get a tattoo, because we know those brains are not fully developed, especially in that judgment area. And so I do believe a school, as the publisher, as was mentioned, should have a final veto power. It should be rare, because I do think First Amendment's important for our kids. I don't know if that could be worked in without ruining your whole bill, Rep. Yoakim, but just my thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you. Closing remarks, Chair Yoakim.
Thank you, Chair Pryor, and I do agree with everybody at this table. And they are growing brains. In fact, our brains are growing until we're 26. So it's important to have those teachable moments. We all know that, those of us who are parents in the room as well. But those teachable moments need to happen in a safe environment with trained teachers, and that's what this bill does. And once again, to Subdivision 3, the unprotected expression, the district does have veto power over that. And kids need to practice this in that safe environment. They need to be able to stretch their wings so they're ready to fly when they leave high school, because the light just doesn't turn on when they're 18 and they're off on their own. So this bill does have those protections. And I want to thank Representative Erdahl. You were out of the room, and I thanked you earlier for supporting this bill and working with me on it as well. I also want to thank, and I would be remiss if I didn't thank, the tutelage of my journalism teacher, who at times did tell me, yeah, no, you can't do that, Bev Skoglund, who taught us those good journalistic standards. And we had a literary magazine, a newspaper, and she was brave enough to have us let a video yearbook went back when we still had video, if you guys even know what that is. But no, I think it's very important to have this, because not all administration might be understanding those journalistic standards in the First Amendment. And there has been a lot of discussion about Hayeswood and Tinker. Unprotected expression that you're seeing in Tinker that we put in this bill, Hazelwood went way beyond that when they did their ruling. They went way beyond looking at that unwarranted invasion of privacy, because under Tinker, the district would have been able, they would have been able to censor if that was too identifiable for the student, and they still can now. So you have that on line 2.24, constitutes an unwarranted invasion of privacy. We talk a lot about data in this committee, and it's kind of aggregated or disaggregated, so that's in here. So I'll go to my final comments then. Over the years, a few cases regarding the First Amendment rights of students have gone all the way to the Supreme Court, and we've mentioned two of the major notable cases tonight, Tinker v. Des Moines and Hayeswood v. Kuhlmeyer. In 1969, Tinker v. Des Moines dealt with students having the right to wear armbands in schools to protect the Vietnam War. In that case, the rights of students were upheld. In 1988, Hazelwood v. Kuhlmeyer dealt with the censorship of two articles in a student newspaper. This case overturned the First Amendment protection of students. Hazelwood went way beyond Tinker and way beyond what I would say would be good journalistic standards or the students having the First Amendment rights, but that's the law we live under today, is Hazelwood. And don't take it from me, you can learn a lot from reading court opinions. I've reread them again because it had been a while. You can read a lot from reading both the supporting and the dissenting opinions. And it's an interesting look at a period of time and what period of time that was. Tinker was under a liberal court. Hazelwood was under a conservative court. There are a few things that struck me when I read the dissenting opinion of Justice William Brennan in Hazelwood v. Kuhlmeyer in 1988. Justice Brennan stated that a journalism class is a forum established to give students an opportunity to express their views while gaining appreciation of their rights and responsibilities under the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. I think as adults, we have to remember that too, that we have a responsibility when we choose the words we choose. He also restated from Brown versus Board of Education that public education serves a vital national interest in preparing the nation's youth for life in our increasingly complex society and for duties of citizenship in our democratic republic. Now, this was 1988. Can you imagine what Justice Brennan would think of 2023? And that he also said that the public school conveys to our young the information and tools required not merely to survive in, but to contribute to a civilized society. In his dissenting opinion, Justice Brennan was clearly concerned that the Hazelwood verdict would stifle student expression and growth. He recognized what many of us in this room know, that the schools are incubators for our future leaders. It is where they gain the skills to be critical thinkers and grow into adults who can contribute to our civilized society. In Tinker v. Des Moines, the Supreme Court struck a balance. They held that official censorship of student expression is unconstitutional unless the speech materially disrupts classwork or involves substantial disorder or invasion of the rights of others. Hazelwood disrupted that balance, and we desperately need to find that balance again. This bill, House File 4083, begins to right the scales. It will allow our students the freedom to learn, grow, and set their thoughts to flight. So, members, I would appreciate your support.
Thank you. Thank you. And with that, Representative Joachim renews her motion to re-refer House File 4083 as amended to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion carries, and House File 4083 as amended is on its way to the floor. Thank you. All right. Representative Frazier. House File 4373. And thank you again, those that came today to testify. We appreciated hearing from you directly. And there's another interesting bill coming up.
All of our bills.
Yes. All right, our next bill for consideration is House File 4373. And members, it's our intention to re-refer this bill to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee for further consideration. Representative Frazier, would you please move House File 4373 before the committee to be re-referred?
That is my motion, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, and I believe you also have a DE2 amendment, which means that basically we should just be talking about the DE2 amendment. And so let's move the DE2 amendment before us. Any discussion of the DE2? All right. That's your motion then, to move the DE2 before us. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. So now we have the bill before us with the DE2 added. Please begin your presentation.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members, folks in the audience. Thanks for being here as we earn this late hour of the evening. I know we're all probably ready to get home at some point, but there's one more bill after this, but I will be as concise as possible. This bill really is about, we have this phenomenon now that is kind of sweeping across the country where we're seeing groups or individuals supported by groups that have an agenda to remove certain books out of our libraries, public libraries, school libraries. And, you know, I don't have an issue with taking a look at materials and determining whether or not those materials are age appropriate or just inappropriate for our students. What I have concern with and what this bill seeks to address is the particular books based on particular authors, their background, their lived experience, or their political ideology are being targeted. And that is my concern. It kind of goes back to this First Amendment expression that we've talked to with these prior bill presentations. I am concerned about that. And this bill looks to address that. And I will say the conversation started in the interim. The conversation will continue. I don't believe that the bill as it is today with the DE amendment will be the final bill, because I will continue to have conversations with individuals and associations that have a stake in what we're doing here. But I do believe we need to do something to have some uniformity across the state, so it's very clear about what the process will be in terms of how we choose the material that's in our libraries and then how we take a look to reconsider those materials to determine if they are appropriate or not for our students. So that is what this bill seeks to do. It has to go to judiciary because there is a private right of action. And they're still working on that as well. We want to make sure that it is tailored to address what I'm trying to address here. And what I'm trying to address with the private right of action is to deter outside groups from coming in and funding these attempts to remove, restrict, or ban books based on particular ideology or political affiliation or cultural perspectives. I want to make sure that we have something there as a deterrent for that. And the reason being is because it is a cost. It is a monetary financial cost to our districts, to our libraries, when these requests are made. And in some cases, they are made multiple times. And you, those have a cost, and they quickly add up to the dollars that are being spent on these. And in some cases, folks bringing these requests, they know that the book may not specifically be inappropriate, but it is something that they don't like, the ideology or the author of the book's political affiliation or cultural or demographic backgrounds. So we want to have a mechanism in there to address that when possible. So that is what the bill seeks to do. I know that we have multiple testifiers, so I will yield and allow the testifiers to state their case.
Great, thank you. First on my list is Carlton Laster, out front, Minnesota, and after that, Kendra Redman, if you can be ready. Thank you for joining us this evening. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you, and sorry for my attire. I'm just coming from a youth summit all day. Hello, Chair Pryor and committee members. My name is Carlton Laster, and I'm the Director of Policy and Organizing for Outfront Minnesota, the state's largest LGBTQ plus advocacy organization. In this role, I am privileged to advocate and push for policies that benefit Minnesota's LGBTQ plus community and address disparities. Today, I am speaking in favor of House File 4373, the book ban prohibition. As a queer Black man, I can tell you how hard it is to see representation based on my own personal experience. As a writer and poet, I can tell you that I write about the intersections of race, culture, sexuality, and politics, the things that shape who I am and what I do. Reading and writing literature has always provided an escape for me. It allowed me to imagine a better life. It allowed me to communicate my hard feelings and truths to my family and friends, and it allowed me to come out to my family. My writing is aimed to be an entry point for BIPOC peoples and those who are typically disengaged or do not see themselves in poetry. That is why I find challenges to books in Bloomington, Lakeville, Annandale, and other communities in Minnesota so injurious, not only because the BIPOC and LGBTQ communities there, not only to the BIPOC and LGBTQ communities there, but also to the residents at large. When queer and BIPOC students read Audre Lorde, Lorraine Hansberry, Langston Hughes, County Cullen, Nikki Giovanni, James Baldwin, George C. Wolfe, and Jacqueline Woodson, they're able to see themselves fully in our history and text. All students should have that same opportunity and the chance to engage with the complexities of our diverse human experience. When books are removed from libraries, it harms everyone, and it closes opportunities to foster curiosity and healthy conversation. I respectfully ask that the committee votes to approve House File 4373, and I thank Rep. Frazier for their leadership on this initiative.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Kendra Redman, and after that, Jay Belcito. And if you can, Kendra Redman, if you can identify yourself, your organization, and begin with your testimony.
Good evening. Thank you to the committee and to Chair Pryor for the opportunity to testify. My name is Kendra Redman, and my pronouns are she, her. I'm a Bloomington resident with three kids in Public School District 271. I'm testifying in support of HF 4373. Last fall, a group petitioned our school board to immediately and permanently remove 28 titles from our K-12 public school libraries. Their list contains primarily books featuring or written by members of the LGBTQ plus community and people of color. This set off alarm bells for many parents. Public and school libraries exist to serve their richly diverse communities, not the personal beliefs of some. We have been fighting the petition and its harmful rhetoric for more than 7 months now. Perhaps our most important efforts have been supporting the amazingly courageous students speaking out against the proposed ban at great personal risk and being a voice for those students unable to do so. At public school board listening sessions, we've heard from students and alums that the library was quite literally a lifeline, the first place they saw themselves reflected and realized that they were not alone. We've heard students defend their right to access books with characters who mirrored their identities, situations relevant to their lives, and topics that are difficult but necessary to talk about in their world. We've heard from high school students who responded to the library's being, and I quote, under siege, by forming a large and active Bloomington Freedom to Read Club. We've heard middle and elementary school students, some barely old enough to stay home alone, tell the school board that they benefit from reading about characters like themselves. And reading about people who are different can help us better understand each other, they told us. Minnesota communities and our children should not have to fight for access to books. As adults, we must show our students that they matter, that we will protect their safety, inclusion, and education. We must ensure their access to books deemed appropriate by librarians, media content specialists, and educators. They are looking to us to act. I urge you to support this bill and our freedom to read in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, Jay Belisito, Gender Justice, and after that, Dr. Terrence Murrow again. If you can identify yourself and begin.
Hi, thanks for having me. My name is Jay Belisito. I'm with Gender Justice. It's a legal and political advocacy organization dedicated to advancing gender equity through the law. I'm here to support Representative Frazier's bill H.F. 4733, prohibiting book banning in public and school libraries across the country and in Minnesota. There are efforts to ban books that provide accurate lessons about the role of race, gender, and civil rights in America. Most of us believe that students should have the freedom to read books that explain our world and help them to become the best versions of their authentic selves. Books are tools for understanding complex issues and challenging issues, and targeting books with LGBTQ inclusion and with censorship is an attempt to erase trans and LGBTQ people from public life. These efforts promote discrimination and send a harmful message to youth that being LGBTQ is wrong. Reading is a foundational skill and it's critical to future learning and exercising our democratic freedoms. I'm also here as a parent and a former educator in Minneapolis Public Schools. My oldest just graduated from Patrick Henry on the north side last year. All of my children go to Minneapolis Public Schools. And this is just it's very urgent that we encourage our children to continue to access these resources and that our children have literature and media that reflects their identities from their ethnicity to their sexual orientation to their gender orientation. I can attest that unfortunately children are not rushing to the library to check out books. It's actually quite a pull sometimes to try to get them to find books that interest them and get them in the library more. So definitely this is something that can really help encourage a really necessary skill. So thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thank you for testifying. All right.
Chair Pryor, members of the committee, my name is Terry Moore. I'm Director of Legal and Policy Services for the Minnesota School Boards Association. I did not lose my job after my last testimony. I just want to offer a little guidance and some experience from the MSBA perspective. I would say that library book policy was the number one request of our 331 school districts throughout the state of Minnesota within the last 2 years. Please help us. Help us set up procedures. Help us set up approaches. And Representative Frazier and I, we've had chances to talk about that, and I'm grateful for that. I will tell you what our model policy does. It does two things. It talks about selection of books and reconsideration of books. Selection of books, the school board can set up criteria for guiding the selection committee. on what books to put in which library. The key word, and thank you, Representative Frazier, is appropriate. Books should be appropriate to the school that they serve. Elementary books and high school books in two separate libraries serve two different audiences with two different levels of appropriateness. So we deal with selection. Then we deal with reconsideration. I would like to reiterate that under our model policy, any parent, any time, can direct the school library to not allow their child to check out certain books. That is very similar to what we do in Minnesota law for instructional materials. Beyond that, we set up a reconsideration process by which any member of the school community, doesn't have to be in the school, can be a resident, taxpayer, whomever, can request reconsideration of a book. A committee is set up, and the school district can choose what appeals processes it has. With that said, Representative Frazier and I have had a chance to talk. We've also talked with the Minnesota Department of Education, and I've told you that as well, that we're just trying to work in a way that the process is good and that we focus on appropriate books and we're not put in a position where inappropriate books end up on our school bookshelves. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Right, and finally we have from the Department of Education, Legislative Coordinator Megan Arroyo. If you can identify yourself and begin with your presentation.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Megan Arriola. I'm the Legislative Coordinator at the Minnesota Department of Education. Thank you for allowing me some time to speak to the committee about the value that public and school libraries provide our state and why we believe that protecting access to information is so crucial for this day and age. As we presented to this committee last month, the governor's education policy bill contains language that would ensure access to library materials free from politics. Since we presented the original language in committee, MDE has been engaged with a number of interested parties, including the School Board Association, librarians, and other groups to hear feedback, concerns, and language recommendations. Some prefer the language before us today, some prefer the governor's original language, but overall, we're working toward final language to meet the intent that we all share. The biggest takeaway from these meetings is that there's overwhelming support for protecting Minnesotans' access to information at their public libraries. I'd like to thank Representative Frazier for being a partner in this endeavor, and we're committed to continue these discussions around what final language looks like, hear creative and constructive feedback, and develop the best language that protects the invaluable contributions that our public libraries provide our state. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Having no more testifiers, we will move to member discussion. Representative Keeler, I saw you first.
Oh, I wasn't. I was looking at the book guy over there. You don't want to go talk about how great books are at all.
Well, I could list my books, but you
know. It's your chance. Okay, I'll, thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Frazier, for bringing this. I do want to take just a little bit of time to talk about books and what that really means to people like me, like my kids, like the kids I've worked with. So when I was a liaison, I was a big part of a group that met every summer with middle school kids around mirrors, windows, and sliding glass doors, and how what we read really impacts who we are. As an indigenous queer person, I say in a lot of spaces, like in the classroom, I never saw teachers who look like me, and I have 4 degrees. I definitely never saw who I was or my family structure in any books that I read. And we know that when it comes to literacy, you know, like kids who have more than 20 books in their home growing up tend to go to school for almost 3 years on average longer because they have books. But I have a 7-year-old, and if any of you guys work with kids, like, kids have to be engaged in what they're reading. They have to like what they read. Like, we read about dinosaurs and dragons, but we also read about people who look like us. When my son read, there's a book that's around Sharice Davis, and it's Sharice's Big Voice, and it talks about being a Native American woman running for the legislature. And when my son read that, the first thing he said was, like, look, Mom, that's you. Because he could see his family, who he was, in a book, and that was new to him. My older son never had that either. The concerning part of what books end up on this list, out of the 100 banned books, one of the top books that's banned is The Absolute True Diary of a Part-Time Indian by Sherman Alexie, which I let my middle schoolers read all the time. It's actually a real-life story about our pain, our honest, true struggle that we go through. It's written from a perspective that's real. It gets banned because it's too graphic, and there's like issues that are real to who we are, and we need to be able to connect with that. We talk a lot about mental health. We talk a lot about life expectancy. We talk a lot about making healthy choices. But when we can't read books that express or show who we are, who our family structures are, who the makeup of who we believe we are from a cultural component, it really hinders our literacy. And I've heard this group specifically talk about how important literacy is and getting all of our kids to levels. If you look at the kids in the breakdown, we've looked at the data enough to show it's kids who look like me and my kids who really struggle with literacy and long-term reading. And so to start banning books that reflect or show this mirror of who we are only impacts our literacy in a negative way long-term. And so it's more than just which books we can read. It's really about showing our next generations that they belong in these spaces, that they can be authors, that they can share stories about the realities of who we are. And I believe that that's really, really, really important. And so thank you for bringing this bill. Thank you for allowing us to have the conversation. Thank you, MDE, for getting all of the stakeholders involved to have honest conversations about this. And I do believe we want to protect the voices of our future generations and making sure that we're visible. I've said it in a lot of spaces that representation really matters, and in our books it does. Your families matter just as much as my families matter, and we deserve to see that across the board. So thank you.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair. And I'm gonna thank you, Representative Frazier. As a teacher for a long, long time, I'm listening to many of the things that are here, that I've been hearing, and I taught many of these books. I know what we're talking about. But I want to pivot because I believe that as we're looking at what what we're asking our schools to do, and what we as a committee are to do, which is to make sure that our kiddos are learning. I want us to ground this discussion in the fact that 49% of our students can't read at grade level. I want us to ground our discussion that 47% of our third graders cannot read at grade level. And I want us to understand that while we're talking about this, every book is banned for a child that doesn't know how to read. They can't read. It doesn't matter what book you put in front of their face. Every book is banned for a kiddo that cannot read. And that's what we should be focusing on right now. That's what we should be doing. We started with the READ Act, and that's great. But that's what we should be focusing on, because our schools already tell us they still need time to do that. And so I want us to really think about what our priorities are, because I heard from the testifier. Where is my testifier? I keep all their notes. That reading is a foundational skill that protects our future democracy. That was what one of our testifiers said. Gotta know how to read. In the last 10 years, we've had a failing system of what's happening here, and especially in the last 4 years where we've seen a 16% drop of students who are failing proficiency tests. We need to focus our priorities and address the fact that we need to make sure our kiddos know how to read. Focus on the science of reading and really prioritize that and ground ourselves in those things before we take up something like this. Thank you, Representative Frazier. Thank you, Chair Pryor.
Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A quiet bunch today, or this evening. We're all tired, right? I don't know if I could say it much better, Rep. Mueller. Thank you. I loved reading. First of all, I love libraries. I love books. One of my favorite parts of teaching was reading to my kids, my students. I loved it. And one of my favorite places to be is a library. I love libraries and books. But when I was a kid, I did terrible in school. If you saw my grade school grades, not good. C's, D's, not until about ninth grade. But one thing I could do was read, and I think that was my saving grace. And so that's, again, what I want to focus on, as Rep. Mueller said. We have half of our kids in our state that can't read. doesn't matter if it's an inappropriate or appropriate book, a banned book or an unbanned book. If you can't read it, it's not going to do you any good. You can't enjoy it. You can't learn about your culture. You can't learn about history or just enjoy a great story. So I'm going to encourage us to focus on literacy skills and get down to these basics that we really need to so we can get our students up to level. Thanks.
I think we'll go to closing comments. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do appreciate the conversation, although a little muted, unexpectedly so. But I appreciate that. I will hold to what I said earlier. I will continue to have conversations. So if anybody has any questions, please reach out to me, and we can talk about this as we continue to move this bill. You know, I understand the disparities that we have in this state. You know, people, kids that look like me fall within those disparities quite frequently when it comes to the educational outcomes, and particularly the reading stats that you just threw out there. But, you know, it doesn't mean that we can't prioritize multiple things at once. We're tasked with doing that every single day that we come in here when we work on multiple bills. I've got bills in almost every setting, every committee within this legislature. And many of them are priorities. I don't say that I won't, that I will decline to do one because one is more important. At the end of the day, there's an intersection, a cross section between these priorities that require us to do more than one thing, require us to walk and chew gum at the same time. This is one of those priorities. So we have to, with fidelity, stick to it to ensure that our kids have access to learning materials that will provide them with experiences that will help them as they go out into the world. Well, they're experiencing the world now, actually. Let me take a step back. They're experiencing the world now. And if we don't continue to create opportunities so they can learn about the world, where they are, that was the most important thing for me about having the opportunity to have access to reading materials. It took me on trips around the world in my small bungalow house on the south side of Chicago. Took me away from that place. No matter what was happening outside, I read those books, opened those books, and I was gone from all the negative things for hours on end. That is what we want to ensure that our kids, the next generation, continue to have. That's why this bill is important. That's why reading is fundamental. It's also important that we make sure they can read. But this bill is just as important because it's important that they have access to those materials. So I'll close with that. There's more work to be done, and we'll do that work. We'll keep having the conversations, and I thank you all for the conversation. I'm looking forward to more.
All right. And with that, Representative Frazier renews his motion to re-refer House File 4373 as amended to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion carries, and House File 4373 as amended is on its way. Thank you, Representative Frazier. Thank you for the discussion tonight, members. I'll do that. Okay. All right. And finally this evening, we will hear from Representative Burt, House File 3546. Let's see. And so it is our intent to lay House File 3546 over for possible inclusion in a policy bill after further consideration. And I know that, Representative Berg, that you do have an A1 amendment and that you had also considered another amendment that you had wanted to present as the bill instead, but there had not been enough time to get that posted. And so I think maybe I'll let you describe the A1 amendment and then also the amendment that you would like to that it will not be before us, but that is one that you're considering for this bill. So Representative Berg.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. That's correct. So the A1 amendment is just striking lines 1.18 and 1.19. And so that's what the A1 will do. We want to remove that language, get the bill in the order we prefer. And then, so you're right. We didn't have time to really finesse the language on this amendment that we will maybe update next week, I believe. And it will just kind of update the language of 1.15 and 1.16 to say updated curriculum that includes helping students abstain from sex. That'll just be the new verbiage once that amendment language gets put on.
Okay. And I apologize also. We did not make the motion to bring the bill before us as we start to discuss it. And so, Representative Berg, would you like to make the motion to bring House File 3546 before the committee to lay it over for possible consideration?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is my motion.
All right. And we will now, after that discussion, we'll adopt the A1 amendment. So the bill before us will include the A1 amendment. Any discussion of the A1 amendment? Thank you. All in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. The A1 amendment is before us. All right. All right. So thank you, Representative Berg. Please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a relatively simple but really important bill. What this will do is update the current sexually transmitted infections, including language, including human immune deficiency virus, or HIV, and human papillomavirus, HPV. We all want young people here in Minnesota to have access to the information that they need to grow up safe, healthy, and confident. With STIs on the rise in Minnesota, we need to ensure all young people get scientifically and medically accurate information to make healthy decisions. Schools have been required to teach HIV education for 35 years and STI education for 24 years. STIs are often very stigmatized, yet most are treatable and all are preventable with knowledge about safe sex. This bill updates a statute to ensure that all Minnesotans get the information they need to protect themselves and their communities against STIs now and in the future. So the three main things this bill does. First, the bill changes all references to technically accurate to scientifically and medically accurate. This ensures that the information will be of the highest standards. This language is similar to what we see in other statutes. Second, as we mentioned prior to me starting these remarks, that we're still working on the language around abstaining from sexual activity, and we'll have that amendment next week. The best STI education is an emphasis on the facts, and the reality is that by the age of 30, 93% of people have had premarital sex. Also, these show how important STI and STD education continues to be for high school students. So with that, I think that I have a testifier here.
All right. I have on my list Dr. Elizabeth Bard Henke. OBGYN, Abbott Northwestern Hospital. Thank you for being with us this evening, and we hope this was not as inconvenient as it probably was.
I missed bedtime with my two-year-old, but it's all right.
Oh, thank you. Thank you,
okay.
Thank you for coming.
Thankfully, I have a husband at home who could take care of her. So.
All right. If you'll identify yourself.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Pryor and Education Policy Committee members. My name is Dr. Elizabeth Bart-Henke, and I'm the Vice Chair of the Department of OBGYN at Abbott Northwestern Hospital, and a fellow of the Minnesota section of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. ACOG represents nearly 1,000 providers of women's health care in Minnesota, and we as a group strongly support House File 3546. According to the CDC, protective sexual health behaviors, including condom use, HIV testing, and STI testing, worsened from the years 2011 to 2021. Among high school students surveyed in 2021, 30% reported having had sexual intercourse, nearly 50% did not use a condom with last intercourse, 8% had been raped, 9% had ever been tested for HIV, and only 5% had been tested for sexually transmitted infections in the past year. Nationally, about 20% of new HIV cases and more than half of new STIs were in teens and young adults. These trends are consistent for our teens and young adults in Minnesota. The Department of Health and Human Services released a sexually transmitted infections national strategic plan with a stated vision that, quote, the United States will be a place where sexually transmitted infections are prevented and where every person has high quality STI prevention, care, and treatment while living free from stigma and discrimination, end quote. School and community health programs have been shown to improve the adoption of positive health attitudes and behaviors that persist into adulthood, including behaviors that can reduce the risk of HIV and other STIs, decrease relationship violence, and sexual assault. The CDC and ACOG support comprehensive sexuality education that is medically and scientifically accurate and unbiased and promotes healthy behavior. These programs should address the needs of all youths, including those that are not sexually active, as well as those that are. All youths deserve to be educated on consent, relationship violence, and sexual assault, and to be given the skills to protect themselves and others from HIV, STIs, and unintended pregnancy. Abstinence-focused education contributes to the stigmatization of STIs, associating these infections with immoral or irresponsible behavior. Stigma discourages public conversation, disclosure of infection, care seeking and treatment, further propagating the spread of STIs. Sexually transmitted infections can have both temporary and lifelong consequences for those impacted. I distinctly remember a teen patient I cared for who was pregnant. Her delivery itself was uncomplicated. Sadly, shortly after the birth of her infant, the infant became severely ill and died from herpes encephalitis. The mother had no, known history or symptoms of herpes at the time of her delivery. Within a week of her delivery and after the death of her infant, she presented with disseminated herpes, was hospitalized and treated. She recovered from this infection and was counseled extensively about her herpes diagnosis, how to prevent the spread of herpes to sexual partners, as well as prevent maternal child transmission with future pregnancies. House File 3546 will align Minnesota law with the recommendations and guidelines supported by the CDC, ACOG, and the American Academy of Pediatrics. These changes will educate and, through information, help improve the health and well-being of young Minnesotans throughout their lives. Thank you for your time and consideration, and I hope you will all support this bill.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, and we are very grateful that you are here with us this evening. Thank you. All right, having no more testifiers, we will move on to discussion. Representative Bennett.
Everybody wants to go home and go to bed, I guess. Okay, I'm ready too. I will keep it short. I do have a question. For you here on line, well, I don't know if I have the amended one. The part 1.14 here, no, ma'am, okay. Unbiased, where it talks about, it adds the word unbiased. So I guess my question is, what is the definition of unbiased? And then second follow-up question, all that similar, is who decides what is biased or unbiased?
Representative Burke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Lee Bennett, for the question. So what we're doing with this bill is to ensure that we, when we are teaching students about sexual health, that it is scientifically and medically accurate. And so it's taking any value-based language out of it. So unbiased is basically scientifically and medically unbiased, like just the facts.
Representative Bennett?
Thanks, Madam Chair. So but bias is somewhat subjective. I'll give you an example. Well, first of all, I would have to say we're all biased to one extent or another. And I'm thinking of a statement such as, okay, let's say one person says to a child, you and only you can decide when you're ready to have sex. And the other person says, it is best practiced and healthiest to wait until marriage or a long-term relationship before you have sex. Two completely different statements based on kind of the bias of the person. So who decides if that's biased or not, or which statement is biased? I think that term is kind of vague, so you could flesh it out a little bit.
Representative Burke.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Lee Bennett. I hear what you're saying. That is an excellent point. I think when we're talking about how we're teaching our students about their sexual health, about STIs and how to prevent them and what they mean, we want to use language that is value neutral. So we are not going to say waiting until a long-term relationship or marriage is the best way to prevent an STI. We're going to tell you that medically and scientifically, these are the ways that you can protect yourself from an STI. So we're not bringing value-based language into it, just medically accurate.
Representative Bennett.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So medically and scientifically accurate, I mean, if I were arguing that term, I would say that it is very medically and scientifically accurate that if you abstain from sex, you're not going to get an STD or get pregnant, but that's, we won't argue that. I'm kind of confused as to why the word unbiased was put in here, because we are moving, we have medical information, and then we move into, in this type of instruction that we're looking at, into moral and religious and all those things wrapped up in those things type issues, which are by nature rather biased. And so, again, I'm going to go back to my point I made the other day in a similar subject, that this belongs, maybe that was just this morning, I don't know, getting confused. I don't know. I have lost track of time. These decisions really belong at the local level, where they can decide what's biased and unbiased, and you know, give the major things that need to be covered, and let the locals figure it out. The state can provide many, many different materials, guidelines, toolkits, all those things. Let them choose what fits their local needs within the guidance that, you know, can be given through these model curriculums and things. I would really encourage looking at that word unbiased, because I think it's kind of biased. So I'll stop right there. Thank you.
All right. Closing comments, Representative Berg.
Certainly, we are getting this done in a rather fast fashion, which is great. I guess I'll just say in closing, I hear what you're saying, and as I'm looking it over, I can see what you're getting at. I think another way we could put it is that it's, you know, maybe non-judgmental. We're not assigning values or judgment to the information that we're presenting our kiddos. And I think it's pretty simple. It just comes down to making sure that our kids, our students, have access to the information that they need to grow up healthy, and I did not expect the story that we heard from our testifier, but that is exactly why we need this bill. I'm sure that story, times a thousand other stories, would illustrate how important it is to make sure that our students are equitably receiving information that is medically and scientifically accurate, so that they can, we were talking about how our brains don't fully form until we're 26 years old. So we need all the help we can get to make wise decisions at a time in our lives when lots of decisions seem hard. And so this is an opportunity for us to ensure that students have the information that they need without judgment in their schools to make their own healthcare decisions. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Berg. Thank you for the discussion that we did have. Thank you also, members, for staying this evening and participating as everyone did fully in the bills that we heard today, and it's been one long day. Yes. But with that, Representative Berg renews her motion to lay over House File 3546 as amended for further consideration or possible inclusion in a policy bill. All right. The bill is laid over. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you. Thank you, members.